Hi there. I want to begin this episode by thanking a few people like Lucas Womack, Robbie Mims, Thomas Boehner, Link Shell, and Gustavo Murad. All of these people went to patreon.com/duckfeedtv and helped us out. Consider doing the same. Go and check out what you can get for even a small amount of money per month. Additionally, as a heads up, since we don't say it at the beginning of this episode, part one is going to cover up through Operation Meehen. It's probably about like a third of the way through the game if you're trying to avoid spoilers or anything like that. All right, here we go.
My name is Gary Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
My name is Matt Campbell.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs. It is a Games Club podcast.
And this week we are talking about the first half of Final Fantasy X, which is a Japanese RPG developed and published by Square for the PS2 in 2001. Hey, Matt, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thank you for backing us and for selecting this game.
Yeah.
Great game.
Yeah, we really do appreciate it. And I know this is a game near and dear to your heart. Let's talk about, because it's also one that me and Cole have a lot of history with. Played not quite as much history, but played like when it first came out. Let's talk about like kind of why you picked it and what your history is with Final Fantasy X.
Let's see if I can kind of keep this brief for you guys. I stumbled on this game by accident. It was when the game first came out, so I was about 15 or 16 at the time, and it was a rainy weekend. I was at my next door neighbor's house, and we were kind of bored because we couldn't go outside since it was pouring. We were just kind of sitting there, not really doing anything. He was playing CSI on his computer, some CSI game where he was solving crimes, and I didn't want anything to do with that, so I looked over, saw that he had just purchased Final Fantasy X and the strategy guide. So I booted it up and was pretty much immediately sucked in. The main reason was the graphics.
Obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great looking game.
Looking game. And then once I kind of, you know, got past the first little bits of the game, the next thing that really kept me hooked was, again, I'm a big fan of time travel, and I'm sure we'll talk more later on in the episode about the time travel in Final Fantasy X or the lack thereof, but the time travel aspect hooked me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kind of that mystery, mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of central mystery that sets up. For sure.
So once I got to that point, it was, I needed to see this one to the end.
Nice.
How did you navigate that with it being over at your neighbor's house? Did you just play the whole thing over there, or did you borrow it, or?
He let me borrow it once he saw that I was kind of hooked. It was a gift that he got, but he didn't think he was really ever going to play the game. Oh, and so he was like, yeah, you can take the strategy guide in the game.
That's that's kind of him. And he had CSI. he was just trying to see like how many like drug caches were stuffed into how many prostitutes and like all that. Or that's SVU. Yeah. I always get those confused.
It's the only one in my heart.
Is SVU?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just because of Ice-T. No. He was doing his civic duty, solving those crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, PC crimes.
Not a choice I would have ever made, but I'm glad I stuck with Final Fantasy versus a CSI computer game from 2001. Yeah.
So you found this by accident over at a friend's house. Had you played other JRPGs before this?
Actually, no. My primary game choices up until then were usually either a Resident Evil, a Silent Hill, or a Tomb Raider.
High five, buddy.
That's all good. Yeah. Yeah, the good choices before and yeah. Well done. That's good
so
stuff.
This was the first, and it's still, aside from 10-2, I'm not going to apologize about that one, but aside from 10 and 10-2, I've never played another Final Fantasy game.
Oh, wow.
That's interesting. That's a fascinating. I wonder how many people there are for whom that's true, because it has to be some with it being the first one on this new console generation. You know, I always think about people who have just played 7 and moved up from there, but I've never really considered someone who had just played 10.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. I'd be really curious as to what you think about them if you did give them a shot. Like, you know, they are all pretty different. And, you know, to my mind, and we'll get into this, like, none, like the more recent ones, the PS1 onward, none of them are flawless. Like, but there is, they do different things. And that definitely playing those and being a fan of the series and playing every entry up until that point definitely informed my, when I revisited 10 and when I played 10, informed my experience. And it's interesting to think about not having that context.
Yeah. And my context is the most basic you could have, which is like, oh yeah, I anticipated this because I loved Final Fantasy 4 and 7. Like, you know, this was a huge event when it released, you know, kind of not least of which, like, this was a little bit of a system justifying game, to a certain degree.
Cause it was a talkie.
Yeah.
Metal
Gear Solid 2 came out like within a couple of months of each other.
Yeah, yeah. It was a really big deal for kind of showing off the PS2 as a thing. And I think you and I both, Cole, like, we came at it from a different angle where it was just as fans of the series.
Yes.
So it was just it was a time when I was going to play, you know, any of the Final Fantasies that came out.
Mm-hmm.
Which persisted up till 12. Yes. You know, and then I jumped off with 13 for obvious reasons. And I played 10-2, and I'm not here to badmouth 10-2 either. Like, at the time, I was turned off by all the girl power stuff. Now, that wouldn't bother me, I don't think. I don't know that it's something that I'm, like, super eager to revisit, but it's a kind of thing where I'm the version of me that was turned off by that, like, doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
For me, the thing that, you know, so I was kind of the same way, a little bit bugged by the aesthetic of it. Now, it wouldn't be a problem. But the fact that 10-2 ditches the CTB system, it adds job system, yay, and makes the battles real time ish. Boo. That would be the thing that bugs me about it.
I would miss the battle system as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the main thing that I didn't like that it was missing was Aeons.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And the Aeons are extremely cool in this. I'm not gonna spend the entire episode doing this, but I'm just like, man, wonder Matt would think of 8. Because mm-hmm. 8 has a really cool relationship with Aeon, you know, with the summons and stuff, too.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how we all got into it. I was due for a replay, you know, so I was happy. You know, people who are listen to the show know that we don't generally do games this long for a request, but I was due for a replay. Cole is due for a replay. There's a remastered version. It seemed like the stars were right.
Yes.
So let's get into just kind of the generalities of this game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we start out, we are in our viewpoint character is Tidus. Was how I pronounce that.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a young sportsman who was whisked away to a strange world after a horrible disaster. And this is that time travel, dimensional travel, kind of wishy-washiness that we were referring to earlier.
Yeah, yeah. He gets to this land called Spira and finds out that the world that he knew was destroyed 1,000 years ago by this cosmic horror named Sin that kind of terrorizes all of Spira.
Yep. That's also the thing that teleported him.
Yes.
That attacked his gleaming metropolis of weird designs, which we will talk about the kind of general aesthetic of this. I do think this is a good looking game and really impressed me at the time. There's some aesthetic stuff in this that does not work for me as an adult, you know, in 2018,
yes,
as well as it did. And that's mostly when I played it. I know it's 2019. This is not an updating my checks kind of thing. It's most of when I played it.
Right.
That does not work as well as it did when I was a kid or when I was in my early 20s.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of the stuff, like weirdly, some of the stuff that I looked at and was like, eh, that's a little, like it was weird. It was weirdly updated for the HD remaster, like going back and looking at comparisons, specifically thinking about the character designs and stuff. So technologically, this is a milestone game for the series because it does two things first, at least for the mainline games. First is there is voice acting. Which is like it was bound to happen, probably with as cinematic as these games are. There are definite trade-offs with that, and it kind of shows that this is a little bit of an early approach.
Yeah, and I think for me, like the way this lands for me is that like I think roughly about half of it is pretty good.
Yes.
The other half of it I think is pretty bad. So it ends up to me being kind of a mixed thing. Like there's a lot of, I mean, as bad as it gets is flat.
Yeah.
For the most part, you know, like there's some really flat performances. Some of them are very good. Everybody knows that everyone's favorite racist jock, Waka, is voiced by, you know, John DiMaggio, mm-hmm. Bender and stuff. And it just, when he's on, it's funny because it just felt like this is the voice actoriest of these voice actors.
Yes.
So he just by that ends up being very charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
Like you'd never, I was talking about it on Twitter and it was like, you'd never have told me that my favorite character to like hang out with in this game would be the racist jock. Like if you just told me that, I'd be like, no, you know, like, I don't hang out with the guy who hates other people for, you know, the religious, you know, religious bigot. Yeah, the religious bigot, Waka. And I wouldn't have liked him, but I do like him because of the performance, just makes him very charismatic.
Yeah, yeah. And the other performances, when they are not weirdly flat, and I think that Tidus's voice actor, whose name I do not recall, is a little bit divisive just because of the for lack of a better word, whiny tone that he takes in the main part of the game. Like I would have preferred if a lot of his voice acting was done in the narration voice. But that also shows like growth because he's narrating from near the end of the game. When the voice acting is not flat, it aids the sense of melodrama for this. And I think that works for the style of storytelling that Final Fantasy does.
Yeah. And it's also a thing too, for me, since I'd come to this whole series, like that's what all I wanted.
Yeah.
Like my sensibility has changed now and I'm less into voice acting in general because I like having more, you know, kind of more text and more flexibility, which I think you lose with that. We talked about that a bunch on the show, but at the time I was just like, yeah, finally the series I really love, like I can hear how these characters sound.
Yeah.
And I kind of lost my mind about it. I was real, real into it.
Yeah. Are there any performances that like stick out for you, Matt?
I think you guys nailed it. I think Waka is probably the most entertaining when he's actually talking. The only other person I would probably mention is, I think that they save him for the right moments, but it's underrated. But I think even Kamari has some very interesting moments where he adds his two cents. And I think I like how it's delivered.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's such a weird character in this. Like in I remembered regard. Him having a bigger part. You know, I'd filled in just more Kamari stuff. And then when I replayed it, like he's just there a lot of the time. But you're right that they do like just kind of deploy him as a thing. He's also oftentimes the only person who keeps his eyes on the prize as far as Yuna goes, which is really weird.
Yeah.
Like everyone, all these professional guardians are kind of, you know, messing around a lot of the time. And Kamari is the one that like when you go and talk to your party, like he's the one who's like, we should check on Yuna.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we should all be doing.
We all have a job, damn it.
Yeah.
I have a soft spot for Seymour's performance, actually. He does sound like an evil Winnie the Pooh, but there's one particular line, why are you still here, that I think he nails with 100% precision. And in general, like his placidity works for me as a villain.
He's it's interesting to him as a villain in this. I kind of came around, like one of the things we talk about a lot on the show that we talked about with Final Fantasy is Zeromus syndrome, which won't make any sense to Matt since he hasn't played the other games. But just know that as far as Final Fantasies go, this is the one where the antagonist remains roughly the same throughout the whole game.
Yeah.
At least it's related to, whereas a lot of times in other entries, they just pull out this cosmic space whore at the end and just be like, here's a thing you haven't heard of, fight it now. And it's a real bummer. And this one doesn't actually do that. So like, I'm not actually a big fan of Seymour, but I think that it's good that he remains your antagonist or an antagonistic force up until the very end.
Mm-hmm.
Almost too much. I think I don't know, and we'll get there, but we fight him probably one too many times.
Yeah.
See, it's pretty silly.
Yeah. Seymour reaches Genova levels.
Yeah, but Sin at the very least is an antagonist and antagonistic force from the get.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty rare for Final Fantasy to do that. Like that's not noteworthy in another series, you know, like having the antagonist be the actual antagonist should be like pretty common.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not in Final Fantasies.
Right.
But it actually happens in this one. It makes it kind of feel a little bit different, which is cool.
Yeah.
There are also the other big technological advance is there are 3D worlds. So there are just kind of, there are bitmap kind of things where they're needed, but for the most part, you're exploring a 3D world. However, like the flip side of that is explore is a real, you know, kind of half word in that. Yeah. Because there's, you know, usually this game, these games have a large sense of like exploration and freedom. This one does not. There's no world map. Towns of Wilderness are integrated, but they are just kind of short little dungeons.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you do get the airship, you're not free roaming around the world. You're selecting from a menu. So
yeah.
What I found, one of the things I found really interesting is that this really is kind of a dry run for 13.
Yeah.
This is a very linear game.
Mm-hmm.
It does not open up until about 3/4 the way through the game.
I mean, what's your definition of open up? Because by the time it opens up, you can go and you can go to the last battle.
Yeah, yeah. It's opened up like you can go to the end, or like it opens up a little bit once you get to the Calm Lands,
mm-hmm.
where there are some side quests. But that just takes a very long time in comparison to the series or just JRPGs in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to having that fulcrum like at the end of the first act where like now it opens up. It just doesn't open up for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And ends up being a weirdly dungeon-y experience. Like I always kind of felt like I was indoors even when I was outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
In this game, just because my space of like movement was very limited.
Yeah, like you never get to a city that you can really explore. You're kind of cordoned mm-hmm. off to like little districts. And strangely, like they're like for as dungeony as everything feels, there isn't really like a lot of dungeon in this.
Mm-hmm.
this gets into like what is a realm, a kind of hair splitting. But in lieu of dungeons, we actually have these puzzles. You know, at each of these temples. And that's really about it in terms of like going into dangerous spaces.
Well, they take the outside spaces and make them into dungeons.
Yes.
So like an area of forest, as opposed to being like a forest that you explore linearly, will be a set of corridors, kind of like a dungeon.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like a forest is a dungeon in this, like mm-hmm. a desert is a dungeon.
Yeah.
In this, they just kind of repurpose outdoor areas to be, again, to feel indoor.
Mm-hmm.
To me. So there is, I do miss that like lack of like feeling of freedom. Like mm-hmm. getting the airship is usually extremely empowering in the series just because it allows you to do a lot of stuff. And here it is much more of a plot kind of thing.
Yeah. But the reliance on 3D worlds does make the world feel a little bit more dynamic and alive, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's movement that is not just kind of animations in the bitmap, like the camera will follow you in a way that just wasn't really possible before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's camp out on the battle system for a little bit, because I know
please.
That at least for me and Cole, this is the star of the show. This was the thing that impressed us both the most on revisit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the first Final Fantasy game since Final Fantasy III, the Japanese one, that doesn't use the active time battle. Instead, we have something called a conditional battle, where, you know, before things would happen if you didn't issue commands and it was a little bit, you were making decisions under a crunch. Here, everything stays still and it proceeds kind of in a, you know, TikTok ratchet gear kind of fashion.
Yeah. Like in an order that very, pointedly they tell you.
Yes.
The order. And so that player knowledge, like this is a really great example, I think, of like how maybe a first instinct might be to keep the secret from the player, so they have to puzzle it out. But somebody being like, well, if we showed it to him, that opens up a lot more, because mm-hmm. it opens up the player to manipulating this timeline. Mm-hmm. And in a way, the closest cousin to this is Final Fantasy Tactics.
Mm-hmm.
But in Final Fantasy Tactics, you had to go into a separate menu to see this stuff. Here, they just put it right on the side of the screen, and you end up having moves and kind of status effects and stuff that affect this timeline. Like, you know exactly when the enemy's going to act. You don't know what they're going to do,
mm-hmm.
but you know they're going to act.
Yeah.
And you know you have to prepare for that. And you know, I actually am going to get a turn before they get a turn, so I can plan accordingly. Like, it is really, like, pretty close to my favorite Final Fantasy battle system, if not my favorite Final Fantasy battle system. Like, not counting Tactics.
Right.
Really, really great stuff, I think.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love the amount of planning that this brings in, and it turns the toughest boss fights into these very, you know, strategic, almost puzzle-like kind of scenarios. You get more mm-hmm. of that kind of in the post-game, optional game kind of stuff. But like in the back third of this, you know, you get these bosses with, you know, particular gimmicks and patterns that you have to work out. And learning that and mastering it is incredibly satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that, Matt?
Well, when you also add in the layer that you can, there's a lot of the enemies that you can either slow down or you can speed up your party. When you see that, like you guys said, it's an active, it changes based on, you know, different things that you're going to do. If you're going to attack a character with Lulu and use Flare, a lot of times it's going to kick her down and not let her attack for, you know, four or five more turns. Whereas if she uses something like, you know, Waterga, you know, she's going to be able to attack in two turns. And so sometimes you have to look at that payoff and think about that in the long term.
Yeah, they work casting time into it as well, which is really clever. They also immediately show you this. Like, one of the first things that Tidus gets early ability is delay hit, and the very first Aeon that you get has a delay attack. So they really want you to be messing with this right from the start, and I think they do a really good job of signaling that, actually.
Something else that's really good about this is that you can switch characters at will. It doesn't cost anything. So, like, you can game it to where your walking party is all of your fastest people, and then you can swap them out, you know, when their turn comes up to whatever is going to match the demands in front of you.
Yeah. And again, that just having no cost to doing that feels like something that's counterintuitive to game design, but actually opens up a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like, oh, it'll be more challenging if we make the player, like, miss their turn to do this. And it just has that sense of, like, well, what if we didn't? Like, what if we just let them do that at once? What does that open up to do this thing that is ostensibly less challenging, but actually just allows a lot more possibility space? Like, how do we make things challenging around that? And I think they do a really good job. Like, to me, the kind of unqualified win of this game is the battle system, and specifically the boss fights, which are better than I remembered for the most part, and just really, really take advantage of that stuff. And I was just, like, really impressed, because that's the thing that the genre doesn't always do well for me, is keep the battles engaging. And this does a pretty good job of it. Like, there are some high encounter dungeons where you do fall into tappa, tappa, tappa syndrome. Like, you can just, you know, oh, my heavy hitters can just one shot just about everything in here, or two shot them. Like, let's just fight. And those do become boring, and there is too much of that. And that's a problem with the genre. But the bosses and a lot of the encounters actually do remain engaging because of the system.
They do interesting things to mitigate, like, regular random encounters. I don't think it's entirely successful because the encounter rate is too high, but you end up getting enemies of different types, where different characters that you have are like keys for their locks, right? So flying enemies, you want to bring in Waka for those. I think that would be far more successful if the encounter rate was lower, and if there was more variability in the kind of enemy party makeups.
Yeah, the enemy, the palette swap situation in this game is pretty dire. It feels like there are 10 different types of enemies. Like, I know there are more than that, but there's just a lot of, here's a wolf, here's a floating eye, you know, kind of thing. But it would be, I mean, like, every JRPG, I feel like, would be better served by having fewer encounters that are harder, you know, and this game really would have, though. Like, this would have sang with that, just because you have this this diverse tool set. You have this Swiss Army knife of a party, and there are a bunch of different kind of interesting locks, you know? So they do try to switch. They also, like, earlier than other, maybe not as early as 8, but earlier than other Final Fantasies, you get abilities that mitigate your encounter rate. And just get fewer encounters. So I felt like they kind of knew that it was really high, but they didn't want to take away your ability to grind, because it's kind of required a little bit, like, especially for the end game, and especially for the optional stuff.
Yeah. For the, for the post game, it is 100% about completionism.
So it's interesting. It's like a half measure towards, like, really getting there, but you could take this system and just, like, in every encounter you do, or every map, you do 3 or 4 encounters. They're actually pretty climactic and big and tough. And then you get to a boss that actually, like, is representative of everything you learned during that, and you could have, you know, this could have been the one to figure it out. You know, it's closer than most.
This battle system, I think before I said I just want to, like, wrap myself in it like it's a sleeping bag.
It's good. It's really good stuff.
Before we get into talking about overdrives and summoning, and specifically, like, equipment customization, I want to put out kind of a statement that's like a thesis, something that playing this unlocked for me a little bit, which is, a Final Fantasy battle system is, like, they can kind of be ranked where the best ones are the ones that you can break over your knee like they're Batman. I love getting it, like, getting under the hood of these things and figuring out ways to exploit the system. And Final Fantasy X stands stands with the best of them in terms of figuring that out and, you know, customizing your party in that direction.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same reason why 8 is so good.
Yes.
You know, people complain about 8 because it's unbalanced because you can break it. But this goes back to the discussion we had in the first episode of the Baldur's Gate ones, right? Where like being able to make those manipulations and stuff makes the player feel clever.
Yeah.
Like it is giving up the idea of perfect balance in order to have a higher like skill ceiling and strategy ceiling for the player where they can actually apply, you know, they can solve a problem outside of the bounds. It's very emergent kind of to break these things. And that's an intensely powerful feeling. That's like the best thing a video game can do.
Yeah.
Is let the player feel clever about solving a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And this is a great one for that. Like 8 is really, really good for that. That's why I love Tactics so much. Like not only is it just engaging moment to moment, but like you are coming up with these builds to answer these specific problems.
Yeah. And it's a big reason why I stand for 12.
I feel like I'm going to need to start playing some of these other Final Fantasy games now.
Like if you dig this aspect of Final Fantasy X, like I know in one of your emails, you said, like, I'm not somebody who does like Dark Aeons and Penance and stuff like that. But if you dig this aspect, like not all of them are this same flavor, but specifically things like 8 or 5 or 12 give you the ability to get under the hood like this one does.
I think you would dig them. With very like the story of all those things are very subjective.
Yes.
Like 5 is super by the numbers, generic fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And 8 story, I think is fairly weak, but mechanically it's really strong.
Yeah.
So, and then I'm always going to push for Final Fantasy Tactics, which is a different genre, but also allows a lot of customization and messing around with stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff. You should definitely check those out. Like they're worth playing and they're easy to play in 2018.
Oh yeah. He's super easy to get a hold of. Yeah. No.
One last thing to throw in there about the fighting system, especially against the bosses, which is something that I think was a missed opportunity, is you start learning that one of the things you need to do whenever you fight, you know, a boss or a fiend that, you know, that's really strong is you want to try to rotate everybody into the party so that they can all gain the experience points.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But there's no trade-off. It's not like if you just hit them with Tidus that you gain, you know, the potential AP that everybody else could get.
It's not actually split, it's just everybody gets a share. So that's like a Pokemon problem. Like early on in Pokemon, they actually give you an item that makes, you know, characters that don't participate in the fight get XP. That would have been better for this.
Yes.
I think they should have just made all the characters gain the XP every time, just because what is the, you know, the disadvantage to that is like we want you to use everybody. But the way they solve that is by having fights where you can only use certain characters. They do the underwater fights to make sure you're getting Riku off the bench. They do the Kamari only fight to make sure you're using Kamari. Like they still do that anyway. So instead of making it so you had to kind of give them a token hit in the middle of the thing, that ends up feeling a little bit like homework.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know? You got to remember, I need to get Riku in to steal something so she'll get some AP, or I just need to get Kamari in there and waste a turn doing an attack that's only going to do 200 damage.
Kamari is weirdly, he has a really weird place in this party. Like, we'll talk about the individual party members, but I think he has a very strange place mechanically in this game. Yeah. Because it feels like I'll say it now. If you couldn't change people out at any time, it would make sense to have a jack of all trades, like somebody because you use Kamari essentially to make a double
right
for one of your other party members. But you can change. I don't need to have like a slightly worse Lulu. I can just have Lulu whenever I want.
Yeah.
Like it's possible Lulu will die and I won't be able to raise her. But the way they handle that is they make that slot unavailable.
Right.
So there's really no reason to have a backup anybody, you know, they do the multi-class stuff when eventually you finish your sphere grid and like you can start taking people down other paths after they finish their own path. And that's actually like, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But Kamari ends up being very unuseful. And this is my least favorite blue magic articulation in the series.
Yeah.
Like making that only as part of overdrives means I'm just not going to use it very much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a bummer because I like blue magic.
Yeah. Blue magic is great.
Let's talk about overdrives. So overdrives are like limit breaks. You take damage, it fills up this meter. And then every character has different overdrives that kind of have different mini games. They have different methods of getting new moves for their overdrive. Mm-hmm. The strategic option to this, to me, is that you can save them, which is, that's not new to this entry in the series, but that ends up being a way that I got through some of the harder boss fights or harder encounters. Was just, hey, I have, what's his head? Pain.
Mm-hmm.
I have the gigantic Marilyn Manson summon.
An anima.
And I have the anima. I have anima's overdrive saved up. I have a ultimate overdrive saved up.
Yeah.
So that's how I'm going to just get this huge head start on this fight.
Yeah. So. The other strategic side of this is you can customize your characters by giving them different overdrive modes, which changes the way that they gain, the way that they raise that meter.
Yep. They roughly correspond to different play or character types. Mm-hmm. So like when this character heals other ones, they gain overdrive, like, et cetera. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So I like that system a lot. I mentioned summoning Marilyn Manson, summoning is really different and really clever. Like this is the, cause summoning in previous Final Fantasies, was essentially just a big damage spell or like just a big effect. This is way more interesting. This is really cool.
Yeah. So instead of just giving you a pretty visual and doing kind of a big hit, what happens is the entire party leaves and the Aeon, the summoned monster that you bring in, replaces the entire party and has its own abilities, has its own special attacks, and has its own overdrive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these are all really different, and it's tied into the narrative in a way that hasn't been matched since 8.
Yeah.
So really kind of cool.
Yeah. So you talked about this as one of the big things you missed in 10-2, Matt. What makes this game defining for you?
Yeah. What was this special about this?
I think it was just the fact that it was almost like they were pets that were protecting you. I loved that there was that aspect of that they could come in and absorb a big hit from a boss if you needed to, that they could just take that hit for you. I love that added aspect to it, that you had your party that you could rotate in and out, but then you also had this added bit of Yuna could summon these Aeons to come in and fight one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like Pokemon style.
I mean, so you said the magic word before and just now, Gary, Pokemon. I think this is weirdly a game that has taken a bit from Pokemon. Down to one of the entire systems being go and collect all of the monsters in these areas. Yeah, we'll talk about the monster arena when we get to that. But this feels like Square looking at what somebody else has done and reacting to it in a way that they generally don't. Oftentimes to their detriment.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
and especially stands out. There's a few times where you get to go one on one with another summoner in the game, and that's where the Pokemon aspect really starts to stick out.
Yeah. It's literally like I choose you, Ifrit. Like, It's very Pokemon, but the way they, like, I like the point that you're saying that they do, like, kind of care and protect for you, because that plays into, they show up in cutscenes, like, they exist.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they don't really exist in the world in other Final Fantasies quite as much.
Yeah.
Here, though, like, Valifor is Valifor. Like, Valifor just exists in the world. Like, it saves Yuna's life at some point outside of a summon. She didn't have to summon it. So it's just kind of interesting. Like that's an interesting thing for them to do, and it's pretty neat, the payoff for that, like the actual narrative payoff for that, I think is one of the swings in this game that actually works pretty well.
I also like the optional Aeons you can get,
they're really interesting.
There are three of them. Most of them aside from anima, so two of them have completely different systems. Like there's one you have to pay, like Yojimbo's here. Welcome back, buddy. so you have to pay him money, and like what action he does depends on how much you give him and how much he likes you. And then you can summon the Magus sisters, and they're so great. And they have their own like little tactics. Like you can suggest something, but it's all depending on their mood.
And it's three.
Sometimes they don't do anything.
Yeah.
And sometimes they take a break, which not the time for that. See, if I die, you die. Mm-hmm. Like sin destroys the world. Like you're not gonna. There's no place for flower ladies. those are really, really great. Like I love as far as the, I think the actual optional stuff in this game is largely really bad. Like the end game, like getting the ultimate weapons and stuff like that, I think is tedious and bad. And the mini games are bad. I think that getting the extra summons is fun and good.
Yes.
And like they're really worth it, and it feels cool to get them, and they're interesting. That's like the optional content that I think works.
Yeah.
And they're the easiest, I would say, of the side quests.
Yes. Like, yeah, I would get 100 Yojimbos before I will Chocobo race.
Yeah. So pro tip for anybody who's playing the HD remake, make absolutely sure if you want all these Aeons, you go and you do all the Destruction Sphere stuff, because if you leave Besaid, guess who's guarding it when you come back? Dark Veil 4, and he has 800,000 HP.
Yep. And you will have to redo the entire temple thing, which we'll talk about those fuckers. So the equipment in this game works a little bit differently than other Final Fantasies. As opposed to getting a you have an iron sword and you get a steel sword, it's stronger. Equipment does not increases your stats. It has like different kind of aspects to it.
Yeah.
So like you get a sword that has and this can be like standard Final Fantasy things like counter or different status effects. It can also be just they increase your strength, so the sword hits harder.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your actual stat increase or your damage increases are going to come from your character, not from your weapon.
Right.
And you do get the ability to customize these weapons using items to add things onto empty slots and stuff in a way that's like not totally un-Parasite Eve like, just mm-hmm. Having a precedent in Square.
Yeah.
But a little bit different and generally pretty good. This is a pretty deep well.
Mm-hmm.
I had things I favored, so I didn't end up changing out equipment as much as it seemed like it wanted me to.
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty neat.
Yeah. Picking the right equipment is a huge aspect of going into battles prepared. And you can swap out equipment on the fly. So if you get into a boss and they lean on poison real, real heavy, you can use your turn to go in and swap it out. That relates to kind of another point, which is status effects matter in this in a way that they haven't really before. Yep. A lot of the time there have been ups and downs on that, but like blind will fuck you up. And also blind will fuck up your enemies if you decide to use like Waka to inflict it, or if you have blind strike.
This is the strongest poison's ever been in the series.
Yes.
Like poison are a huge deal.
And God forbid you get hit with bad breath.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yep. Like that's always a big deal in these things, but it was only a big deal because of sleep and confuse.
Mm-hmm.
Now having all those things stacked is actually really sucks.
Yeah.
Let's talk Sphere Grid.
Oh man, Sphere Grid. This is top notch.
Yeah. I like it. It's a little less, it's more linear for longer than I remembered.
Mm.
In my mind, and so there's two different versions of this. We'll talk about that in a second. Just I wasn't thinking of the international version. Just when I was young, it felt like this was totally full of tons of possibility right from the beginning. And it you spend a lot of time on rails on the Sphere Grid. Once it opens up, it is actually pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is a good system for it, but it takes a while to get there. It has to like start moving like a train, like it gets up to speed.
Yeah.
I think.
So for people who are listening to this and who haven't played it, Sphere Grid, it's like a big board game board. You have these nodes and each character goes along these paths, and certain nodes you can kind of spend a resource that is pretty abundant to activate that node, and that improves the stats of your character, or you get a new ability, new spell, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no experience. You just get AP from fights in the way that Matt described. If you perform an action, you get those points.
Yeah. We didn't mention this, but you are incentivized to overkill enemies because you get an AP bonus.
Yes.
So if or you kill an enemy by drops. A margin. Yeah. Or what was that?
Or different item drops. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So you start out kind of, every character is kind of start in the regular version, the release version in North America. Every character starts out in kind of a class, like a path that corresponds to a class, except for Kamari, who can start out and can go down any path.
He starts out at the center and he can go into most of the other characters' regions.
Yes.
Some you have to wait longer for, but it may pay off a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And for the most part, he has that kind of flexibility and consequently trades power
mm-hmm.
For that flexibility, because it was consistently my weakest character, like for the whole game.
Yeah.
But as you kind of move through these things, you're increasing your stats as you go through. And there's a lot of little wrinkles they introduce slowly. So like the first one are gates that get introduced, where you can go and kind of jump onto someone else's path or jump onto these kind of optional areas where you need keys. And then you get things that start allowing you to move your pieces to where other pieces are on the board, or just borrow abilities that other people have learned, things like that. Like eventually this becomes very robust. I think like a lot of like my thesis for this game is that it starts out very slow in kind of every way. And this is one of the ways where I wish this had been kind of as robust as it ends up from the start. Like I would not have been, even at 21, I would not have been too slow to pick this up, you know? And then as an adult, I'm just kind of like, come on, let's get to the cool stuff. Like right now I'm just going through a path, and this is for a long time, it's not different than just getting level ups. You know, like I'm just going to take everything that's in my path because I can. And yeah.
What we're describing is the regular one, the regular version of the sphere grid, which, you know,
The North
came.
American version, like we call it the regular one, but it's
Then I
the
suppose,
North American version.
this is the vanilla one. However, the international version, the one that was kind of released for PAL, and then it was part of the re-release in Japan and was included for the first time in the HD remaster in America. There's the expert spear grid, which gives you like everybody starts in the center, and you can pick which direction everybody's going to head.
And the trade-off is there's less overall nodes. So your characters may end up being less overall powerful in exchange for that flexibility. And there's like 50 less.
Matt, you did the expert sphere grid, right?
No, I started late, or sorry, I started early on this. I didn't go back and do the expert sphere grid.
Gotcha.
Yeah, no worries. We're mostly we've talked about it, and I think we people can kind of understand it. Tim, you know, so I'm not too worried about it.
It's
I think for an initial playthrough, I think you want everybody. I think it kind of makes sense with the story that Yuna is a white mage, Lulu's a black mage.
Yes.
You know, I think that's kind of for a first playthrough, you want to follow the regular sphere grid.
I agree. Like, yeah, if anybody's listening to this and they're going to give this a shot, for sure.
So, who did you guys take Kamari through?
Titus. For me, I wanted another time mage, essentially.
I took Kamari through, oh gosh, Riku at the beginning, in order to get her thief skills before you get Riku, because you get her weirdly late in the game. And then I warped him over to Orin because I wanted him to hit harder.
How about you?
I have tried him on each of my playthroughs, pretty much doing everybody's. This one I finally did Lulu's because you have to wait the longest because I think you need a level 3 key sphere to move to hers. And again, it still wasn't worth it. Like you said, he just ends up like a diet version of any other character you're playing with.
A nice can of Diet Lulu.
That's pretty much what he was Diet Lulu.
Yeah, that's it's he's weird. He's really weird ludically. Like, yeah, he it's hard to for him to fit. There's actually way more than I remember as far as mini games are part of the series, starting with seven. Starting a little bit with six, pet ants, but like mostly with seven. And the and Final Fantasy X has a lot more mini games than I remembered. It has one that stands really tall, which is the best one in it, and the rest of them I think are awful. Like I'm not trying to just exaggerate for effect, like catching butterflies, chocobo racing, lightning dodging, collecting 10 of everything. Like I think these mini games in this game are among the worst in the series as a whole. But it's redeemed a little bit by Blitzball, which is pretty fun. That is the main mini game in Final Fantasy X.
You're pro Blitzball.
I am kind of pro Blitzball. I think it feels to me like it has the complexity of like a 2009 iOS like sports sim kind of thing. Like it's very robust for a Final Fantasy mini game. And I didn't play very much of it this time. Like just for full disclosure, for this playthrough, I did all of this stuff when I was younger. I didn't do it all again. This playthrough, I got through the game. I did some side stuff, but I didn't complete it. When I was young, I got Waka's ultimate weapon and did the whole season of Blitzball. Like played a lot of Blitzball as a kid. Or as a early 20-year-old.
When I first played this as a teenager, I was kind of put off by it a little bit because it felt slow and
It's very slow.
it felt slow and kind of awkward and weird, and I didn't really like want to get into the numbers. The shame of it was when I dipped into it a little bit here, I was kind of like, oh yeah, I can kind of see how you can get good at this. The game does you a disservice by having your first playable Blitzball match be like an assured stomping on your part. Like you're gonna go into this and probably lose unless there's a miracle. the tragedy of it is kind of like, okay, I can see how this is interesting and I would love to engage with this system. However, I do not really have time to like mess around in the gold saucer, you know? So that ended up being a bummer for me. Matt, you seem surprised that Gary was pro Blitzball. Like, are you kind of lukewarm on it, or are you like, this sucks?
I've always been a this kind of sucks thing. Just never really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I get it. It's not, you know, as far as Final Fantasy minigames go, like, man, Matt, if you get into Final Fantasy VIII, like, I don't do that thing where I push people to play games very much, because people do it to me and I don't love it. But like, Final Fantasy VIII's minigame is top notch. Like, it's no Triple Triad, but
you mean Final Fantasy VIII is Triple Triad.
Yeah, Final Fantasy VIII is essentially Triple Triad, the game. Like, that game is very, very fun.
Yeah.
This is, I don't know, I just, there's something that I liked about it. I think it's because it was a way of, at the time, since I was so into menu-based games, it was a way, like, playing a sports game through a menu was very novel to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was allowing me to, like, kind of mess around in the world of sports without, you know, still through my, like, little kid RPG brain. I keep saying little kid. I was 21 when this came out. I have a really skewed conception of age.
Yeah.
Guys, I'm sideways Benjamin Button. As I get older, I get younger and older. So
yeah.
I
was listening to a news story and I heard somebody who was 18 described as an adult, and I initially was like, wait a minute. And I'm like, oh yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay. We send those to war.
Cool. Yeah.
They're crusaders now. They get vaporized on a beach.
So Blitzball, I think that there's a lot of depth to it. I was kind of bummed that I wasn't didn't have time to invest in it.
It's the world's hobby.
Yeah. That's weird too. Like, it's integrated into the story in a way, and one whole character's kind of a large part of one whole character's progression is tied to being involved in it.
I feel like it's almost two characters. Like, near the end of the game, I was very surprised that Tidus was just like, when you're blitzing, like, you know, like the gigantic Eldritch monstrosity is about to destroy them. They're like, when you're blitzing, you always go for the score. I'm like, man, buddy, like, we are not, can you stop thinking about football for like 2 seconds? Like, we are all going to die and you're fake. Stop doing this. Like, everyone is just like non blitz all the time. But it plays into the story and plays into the characters a lot.
Yeah.
Another layer of it is that you can go up to characters in all the towns, and if you hit square versus X when you talk to them, you could potentially recruit them for your Blitzball team.
Yeah. Yep. So if you want to go through and if you decide to do that, like, now just use a FAQ. As a kid, that felt very treasure hunty.
Mm-hmm.
I can talk to somebody and just be like, oh, like, you want to play Gwent? Like, let's have you in my Blitzball team. Like, it felt like that.
Yeah.
But now I would just use guide.
Drop everything and come with us. Life has no meaning in Spira. So yeah.
Yep. and it does. You might die.
So all of this plays into this end game, post game that we talked about. Like, you know, these systems, if you take them to their extreme, the mini games, weapon customization, the monster hunting that you do, you know, gets you into this post game, which gets even more ridiculous in the HD remaster / international version, where you fight these enemies that are, you know, ruby weapon 15 times over.
Yeah, like ultimate weapons. And when you take these to their extreme, like, it's not like you take them to the extreme, like, extreme cleverness.
Right.
You take them to the extreme grindiness. Like, you do the grindy task that is what they want you to do to get these breaks.
Yeah.
Because you're getting ultimate weapons that break the limit, which for Final Fantasy, like, fans, like, you just know 9999 is the highest thing can be. And getting that fifth digit does feel cool.
Yeah.
When it pops up. But it's just getting them is really tedious.
Yeah.
Like, that Cactar thing is tedious. That monster arena is tedious. It just takes it's a huge time sink. Like, it is made to be like, if you want this, instead of to being a 50-hour game, you want this to be like a 250-hour game, it can be.
Mm-hmm. Fortunately, not like, none of that's mandatory, or not much of that is mandatory. Like,
and you'll trivialize the end game.
Yes.
Like, if you want the actual story important fights to feel cool, you need to not do this.
Yeah.
Because you'll get to the end and you'll one shot, like, you know, you can potentially one or two shot the end bosses, and it's like, it's empowering, but like, boy, this is the threat. This is the existential threat the world faces. And I just two shotted it. Like, that feels bad.
Yeah. Now summoners and guardians are going to be coming after me. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, click, I'll be your sin. You know, like, I'm just, Tidus is just going to walk the land, just destroying villages and stuff until he sing his favorite song.
Yeah.
You know? So,
Well, yeah. And then it's weird when you find out there's all these other fiends and creatures out there that are much more powerful than Sin, and it's like, why weren't we using these dark aeons all along?
why isn't Dark Bahamut like the thing that's destroying this world?
Like the way the society works, I don't blame these fiends and the summoners and stuff like that for being really, really apathetic and lacking ambition.
Yeah.
Or why hasn't everybody just given all of their money to Yojimbo?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Just like, go take care of this for us, buddy.
Yeah.
Like just Yojimbo versus Sin with the entire world's, you know, purse. Yeah.
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 Let's talk about production stuff a little bit. So there's a really good interview that was done on US Gamer. Gary, you pointed this out. That kind of talks about the complications that voice acting added to this. Specifically, this is the first time Square had really done it, and they, A, didn't know how to do it for their own market, but also didn't have any real consideration for how it was localized. So you ended up with stuff that sounded a little bit weird, because literally every audio file had to match or not exceed the original Japanese limit.
Yes. So it's crazy.
Yeah.
Like it is just wild. Like if you read about what they had to do. So like when they were localizing this, the way it was done, they had to rewrite the game, like localize it to the length of the original script.
Mm-hmm.
So like, it's just, cause I think that the dialogue in this game, there are some good points, mm-hmm. but generally I think it's pretty, padded and awkward,
mm-hmm.
and it's padded and awkward because it had to be.
Yeah.
And there are things that I didn't even consider there in that interview that are really interesting. Like, because of the S sound, saying yes, you can't say that in one frame,
mm-hmm.
but you can say hi. You can say, you know, the Japanese word for yes,
mm-hmm.
In that frame. So if they'd have a character who is just supposed to say, you know, yes in response to something, they couldn't.
Yeah.
Like they couldn't just do that because they didn't have enough time. So some of the kind of contortions that the dialogue will go through, or as is, like, to my mind, like the scourge of the genre, like filler words and just kind of restating things back to the player, and just, you know, long sentences where they should be a lot punchier.
Yeah.
Just can't exist in this game. The game, the technical, because it had voice acting, the technical limitations meant you couldn't do it.
Right.
And it just impacted the game. Like a lot of the dialogue in this game feels very unnatural to me, and that's why some of it feels very natural. And like usually when it's coming out of Joe DiMaggio's voice, because he's a professional voice actor, and they baked his character having a lot of little filler words in.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you notice that Waka always says, you know, yeah, and you know, and things like that, that is to make this work.
Yeah. I'd be really curious. So going to put out a call to listeners. If you've played the German version of this game, let me know how they manage that. Because, you know, in terms of the length of time it takes to say something, German is to English as English is to Japan. It is not a very brief language in terms of like made up words and joining stuff together. So I'd be curious if they even attempted that. Another thing that kind of that kind of gets in the way a little bit is inconsistent direction. So you had Yuna, her rhythm is a little bit clipped because she was trying to match the mouth flaps of the character in animation when that shouldn't have been the case. Nobody else is trying to do that. John DiMaggio, he had that accent for Waka when nobody else in the world has that accent because nobody told him not to. It works for the character. Good.
Well, I was gonna say there's also another interview I read with the voice actress who did Pain in Final Fantasy X-2.
Yeah.
And these were also not recorded in the same room.
Yeah.
Like everyone, and that comes through in the audio, but it just confirmed like the sessions for Square at this time, like when they were doing voice acting, it wasn't a table read or two characters talking to each other. It was one character reading their lines in a vacuum.
Yeah.
With somebody outside the sound booth holding up a cue card with what they're responding to.
Right.
So that kind of stilted nature is baked into the process.
Yeah.
Of it.
And that was like that is and was a thing with anime localization and dubbing.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that is very rarely done because of those matching considerations. That is very rarely done in kind of the ideal way, which is having people in a studio playing off of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's why in the anime community, which I am an expert on, why people love subs rather than dubs.
Yeah.
Because dubs are set up to fail.
Gary, I can't believe you've done this.
Yeah, I'm taking a strong stance on dubs. You know, it's I'm passionate about very few things in this world. Right. Cole,
I'm gonna deactivate my Twitter account.
Yeah, yeah. Goodbye, curious cat. Cat's out of the bag now. Cat's back in the bag. But yeah, it's just interesting that these things that like sometimes I will play a game and be like, this dialogue sounds like no one's talking to each other, and then have an interview be like, yeah, we couldn't talk to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay, you know, that's good, I guess.
Yeah.
That it's made text.
Yeah. That's one aspect of the audio that doesn't work. One that does is the music. I love the soundtrack. It's quite good.
I don't love it. I miss Uematsu. Like I miss the more melody focused stuff.
Mm, yeah.
Personally.
This is the first one where Nobuo Uematsu pulled in help. You can still hear him, specifically with like the use of themes. You have a couple of different kind of leitmotifs that pop up all over the place, which is, I think, the strongest aspect of his composition is finding those hooks and then finding new ways to represent them. Yeah, I dig it. I think that might also be because I'm more into kind of an atmospheric kind of a kind of sound than you are, Gary. This works for me.
Yeah, I miss those strong melodies.
Yeah,
like that's why I associate with him. And there, I think the soundtrack lacks strong melodies, like pretty hard, actually. Yeah. Like it, everything fits.
Yeah,
like nothing feels like it's jarring, but like fitting always feels like the minimum to me. For music, like it just I wanted more hummable things. I love the Besaid theme.
Yep.
I think that's really, really good. I actually like the battle theme in this game. Like it's not my favorite Final Fantasy battle theme, but it's quite good.
Yeah,
I think. But for the most part, I find this kind of unmemorable.
Yeah.
Where do you land on the music, Matt?
I'm with you guys. I really enjoyed the I bought the CD and a buddy of mine and we drove to Vegas and we listened to the entire soundtrack driving there and back. I like the Besaid theme, like you said, but the one that really sticks is, like you said, the fight theme. For the fact that you hear that over and over and over again throughout the game, and to me, it never got old. I think that's a huge win.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a catchy number. Like they do a really good job with that one. One of the things too that I think is actually interesting in this, because I was listening, this is the first time I played the remastered version. The soundtrack are their rearrangements, all of the songs, and they're just like way more bombastic. I actually prefer the original versions pretty hard.
Same.
To the new versions. The new versions just add a lot of just like drums, I guess. It feels like every like cymbal hits on every beat.
Yeah,
it's what, like, it's what it sounds like to me.
It feels bombastic, but in a way that like they took really kind of like really colorful makeup and just slathered it over.
Like that makeup shotgun.
Yeah.
From The Simpsons, you know, like that.
Yeah, yeah. I like the original as well. And a bummer is I don't think you have access to that option on the PS Vita version.
No.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
We should talk about that. So this game got a remaster for PS3, PS4, Vita, and PC. And this is the first time here in America we got the international version changes, the Dark Aeons, the Expert Sphere Grid, things like that. It's a good remaster. I don't like the way they updated the character models but didn't update their animations. So you get like these weirdly pristine, high detail faces that don't really move much.
Yeah.
You know, and even going back to the original, like looking at it, this was very much one of those, it doesn't get better than this games for me in terms of like, oh yeah, this is obviously the ceiling for visual fidelity.
Yeah. Video games will never get better than this.
Right.
Yeah. Or look better than this.
Yeah.
The, and it does look better. It's a pretty good, I like the being able to heal everything in one button.
Yeah.
After a fight. Like that's actually really cool. All RPGs should have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's still, and it's also just easier to play. I played it on my Vita.
Mm-hmm.
So like that made a big difference, is like playing this in bed and playing on buses and stuff.
Yeah. So I forgot that I had this on my Vita and I got it for PS4. That's real cheap there anyway. But then I realized, oh, you can transfer your saves between them. So like I prefer when I'm playing a game for the show, I prefer not to do it portably because I need to take notes while I do that. However, like if I'm grinding or something, to throw it to the Vita and be able to play that in bed as I'm going to sleep and watching The Simpsons or whatever, real big thumbs up for that.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Which version did you play, Matt?
I played this one on the PS3. But I've beat it on the two most recent times before this were the Vita. And like you said, Cole, I love the fact that I could play it while I was laying in bed, yeah, or mm-hmm, I could play it while I was laying on the couch and my girlfriend was watching TV or a mm-hmm movie. Just being able to kind of play it anytime was, I just thought it was fantastic.
Yeah. It's super, mm-hmm, it's super, yeah, neat. It's kind of weird because that's what the Switch is and the Switch does. And yeah, this is coming to the Switch here pretty soon, I think, as well.
Yeah. So you can do it on the Switch too if you like.
Yeah.
This is the first Final Fantasy game to get a direct sequel. Which we alluded to, it's very weird. The happy ending for that undoes all the sadness of this ending.
Yep.
In a way that is very cheap, I think. I just found out about that because I never beat that before. I just researched it for the show and I was mm-hmm like, really? Like really? Okay. That's a bold move. Final Fantasies. But it is different, you know, it's much more kind of mechanically focused, and the tone is very like goofy and fun, mm-hmm, in it, like it, because this is a very serious game. It's very strange. It's a strange sequel that I never beat. Someday I think I will. Mm-hmm. But it focuses on Yuna's story and her kind of being part of this like international, or this like gang of operatives. Very weird.
Yeah.
Very, very weird product.
Yeah. And it kind of like more explicitly brings in kind of a job system, strangely enough, mm-hmm, with dresses and things like that. It's really interesting. I'm probably like, I always say, oh, I'll dip into that. And then I never do, but I'm tempted.
Someday. I don't think I'm gonna do it right away.
No,
but I'm interested. And it does interest, like when we talk about the ending of this game, the actual ending of these, the you know, our main character of this game, that the ending of his story happens in Final Fantasy X2. And it is just reverses what happens in this one.
Yep.
So it is pretty silly. Also, Final Fantasy X2 has a tie to Final Fantasy VII, and then they actually codify that in a book.
Yeah.
And there's a character in X2 called Shinra, and there's a Final Fantasy Ultimania book that says, like, actually, you know, 7 takes place in the same universe as 10, but far in the future and on a different planet. So may as well, I don't know what that's there, just to kind of, like, stoke nerds to just be like, oh, it's in the same universe.
Yeah.
You know, but it's, like, literally, like, if it's not the Marvel Extended Universe, because Iron Man lives on a planet 7,000 light years from Hulk, you know,
yeah,
they have to actually interact for it to be a meaningful extended universe.
Yeah. And all of this takes place in the Myst universe. There just hasn't been a linking book written to Spira.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Everything is just and it's all inside a St. Elsewhere,
yeah, exactly,
in that snow globe or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, they just kind of pointlessly connected two popular games in a way that's kind of frustrating.
Yeah. And weirdly, there have been rumors about Final Fantasy X-3. Yep. As well for a while, but you also have what's his name, Belts and Pockets guy, talking about
Nomura.
Yeah, you have Nomura talking about how he wants to do that.
It involves bringing Sin back, which I just feel like is very frustrating.
Yeah,
like I just, you know, the big swings at the end of this, which are the emotional beats, mm-hmm, and that work, like the to me the plot and theme content in this game that works the best are things they've undone or threatening to undo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Final Fantasy X3, and I just think that's a bummer.
Yeah.
You know, so do we have any other final like general thoughts before we jump into this this road trip, before we pilgrimage it up?
I do not.
None from me.
Excellent. Yeah, let's jump right into it with Xanarkand, the big Tron nightmare hellscape techno club.
This was definitely a weird thing for me because Final Fantasy had been sci-fi for a little bit. You go to the mm-hmm. fucking moon in a spaceship in 4. However, to walk in and have it just immediately be like, this is a techno-utopia, a technotopia, if you will, was pretty jarring. I didn't expect that, especially based on all of the promo stuff, which was, we're having fun island time adventures.
Yeah. And there's a little framing device we get to first with the party singer on this campfire. Everyone's really sad. And Titus walks away and says, listen to my story. This may be our last chance.
Yes.
And when retrospect, when you know what happened, it's very funny because he's just recounting everything that just happened to these people to them. Yeah. Like, do you remember when we fought the third Adamantoise?
Yeah.
I remember it. Here's how it went. Yeah. Do you remember when I gathered all 10 of those, evil eyes from the thing? Well, here's how it happened. Like, you know, but he's just recapping things for them.
Yeah.
And then we flash back to the beginning of his story, which is in the Techno Utopia, which we talked about, where Titus is meeting his adoring fans. He is a sports star in this sport called Blitzball, and everyone wants his autograph.
Yeah. And that's how you select your name. I think this is a pretty good introduction to Titus's character, because he does live this life of luxury where everybody is, you know, kind of sucking up to him. However, like, his displacement into spirit doesn't necessarily sacrifice that either.
Yeah.
Did either of you guys change Titus's name?
No.
I always do canon names for these things. I'm boring.
Yeah.
Like, always canon.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah.
The contortions that they do
to not say his name.
Yeah. Very strange to me. That seems like something that wasn't explicitly necessary. He is hard coded to be a viewpoint character. I don't think that having him named Cole would make me identify with him more. I think it would be more natural if people just said Titus. And also, it would have made me not say Titus for the first 10 years this game was out.
Yeah. Yeah. They should have just made it so you couldn't name him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thing. And it wouldn't be until Fallout 4 that they had a meaningful, like, of thing that could, a voice character that can name almost anything you could put in.
Yeah.
You know? He's talking about how Jecht disappeared. Jecht, we're going to find out, is his father, who is a deadbeat carny.
Yeah, and who is, like, super famous in his world. Kind of a theme in this is walking in your father's footsteps a little bit, because both of the primary leads are people with famous fathers who kind of defined the fixation of the world that they live in.
Yep. So then we show some Blitzball, and this is all, like, cutscene, you know, kind of just like real showy cutscenes
with lots of crunchy guitar.
Yeah.
If this was what Blitzball was like, I could get into it with, you know, Titus knocking guys into the stands, you know, out of the pool.
To look at this. And then actually when you play Blitzball and it's somebody like slowly sidling on up and then choosing from a menu and then everyone politely taking their turn to try to stop a ball and everything like is so stodgy in comparison to this. It's very funny to me.
Yeah. They do a good job of selling the kineticism. And I think when the disaster approaches, nobody notices because they are so wrapped up in the spectacle.
Yeah. It also establishes a couple of things, like one, that Titus can breathe underwater.
Yep.
Not everyone can do it though, which they never really go into that, but it's true. Like, not everyone can do it. And water doesn't have to, like, it's in this gigantic sphere. So water cannot necessarily obey gravity. Like, they have this technology or something to do that.
Yes.
And so does, you know, so do they in the future as well, which is in the future, but effectively more primitive than this.
Yeah.
So Oron is looking over. We introduced Oron as a character who I think is a cool design. Like, I can't scoot past Titus without talking about how he dresses.
Yeah.
Like, we can't scoot past these characters without talking about these Nomura designs. And I'm sorry. I know that's like a real cliche thing and talking about Final Fantasies and stuff, but like this asymmetrical pant belt nonsense stuff that he likes doing, I think, is really gross and bad.
Yeah, this is explicitly where he crosses the line. Like, it didn't really bug me so much in 7 and 8, and those are
they're very restrained.
Yeah, especially in comparison. I think that this might be the moment where Nomura crossed the Hideo Kojima threshold, where nobody told him no.
Yeah, and it just feels like he lost his mind to me. Like, even down to, like, there's an army that we deal with in this game, and they do not have standard uniforms. Like, they all wear different shorts and different, like, you know, army shorts. They wear different shorts and different styles of belts and different, like, helmets that occlude their vision.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's wearing a helmet that goes over their eyes, and I'm like, my dude, like, I don't know. I think that guy should never have worked again after this, like, quite honestly. Like, the character designs in this are like, and it just, when they're good, they stand out. The reason why I brought it up is because I think Oron looks cool.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Oron looks cool because he's guts.
Yeah, he's pretty much Guts. Yeah. I just want Oran and Lulu to go out and be like, as the only two cool people on this world, to go off and make like amazing babies.
Yep.
And repopulate the world in a non-Nomura. Like, go to a moon that like the no Nomura's allowed moon, and just make cool people who know how to dress.
Yeah. I mean, this also might have been kind of aggravated by the fact that Nomura was also working on Kingdom Hearts at around the same time too, probably.
Yeah, and that's not a real winner as far as fashion choices either. So
yeah. This bugged me more now than in my previous playthroughs.
I didn't notice as a kid.
Yeah,
as a 21-year-old, I'm like, oh, this is cool. This is how shorts work. Like, how did I not notice that? Like, I was at that point, I'd realized that like Rob Liefeld art with like tons of pouches and belts like looked bad,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I didn't notice that this did. And mm-hmm. now I'm looking at it, I'm like, Titus, like you, like I wouldn't hang out with you for a million years. Like you like, and I'm not that guy. I don't think I'm cool. I just wouldn't hang, like, it's just like, that guy is trying real hard,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
This is rough stuff.
I think maybe I extended to Titus a lot of, you know, a lot of these designs, a lot of leeway, because for a while I had a poster from EGM of an Amano kind of interpretation of Titus's design.
Yeah.
That was kind of in Amano's real wispy style that looked fantastic.
Yeah.
So, but then with that not hanging over my television as I played this, I was like, ooh, okay.
Yeah, rough stuff.
Yeah.
But Oran shows up and looks like a badass.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently will become and be a badass.
Yeah.
Hisuki on as this gigantic wave is approaching the stadium.
Yep. And a little kid who has been kind of following Titus around on the margins, he freezes time and says, "It begins. Don't cry."
Yeah.
People always tell Titus not to cry.
Yeah, it's a weird through line.
Yeah.
Throughout this, that I think I'm not really sure what they're getting at with at the end. Like, is it bad to cry? Like that's an out of fashion message right now.
No.
You know, this weird kind of the like Jack the toxic masculinity elemental that is Sin.
Yeah.
So this wave is now this huge orb of water that floats over the city, and it is Sin.
Mm-hmm.
Sin is this, you know, it's a general noun, but the specific noun of Sin is this big kind of eldritch monstrosity, like this gigantic like dinosaur creature.
Yeah, it's like a gigantic whale dinosaur.
Yes.
We don't really get a good look at him now. When we do get a good look at him, I really vacillate between thinking he looks pretty goofy and thinking it mm-hmm. is actually like a really good design.
Yeah, it's really dependent.
Yeah.
And it's Final Fantasy wheelhouse stuff. It's not that different than the weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when those were shown in CGI cutscenes in Seven. Like, this is a very Final Fantasy idea. But much like Cloverfield, it spits out a bunch of scales that turn to monsters. And Oran pops up and gives Titus Jack's sword, and we start our first fights.
Yes. And this is a really cool combat tutorial. It feels extremely kinetic, especially mm-hmm. because they lean on these kind of ways to change position, or I forget what they're called, like, you know, context commands or what have you.
Yeah. Move forward or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Charge forward after you've broken the line. Like, you're just kind of like trying to get towards Sin.
Mm-hmm. Like there's a moment when you're surrounded by these fins, and you're like, okay, like, just, you need to focus on the one so we can get through, like, don't kill all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's no back attacks in this game. Like, right. There's no being pincered or anything. So I kept expecting that to be a big deal when that happened, and it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a big deal. Yeah. So you kind of go through and there's doing tutorials. Tutorials happen surprisingly late in this game, or continue to happen. And this is about overdrives. It's teaching you how to just generally battle, a little bit about the timeline. It's all pretty good.
Yeah. But yeah, you battle on this highway, it would take down some buildings and all of that, until finally, like, you get to the end and Sin makes his move, but Oran seems to be able to talk to it, and you are pulled into Sin's big wet void inside him.
Yep. And Titus swims towards a version of his father, but instead sees a young version of himself, and wakes up in this long destroyed temple. Cold and hungry. For the first like 20 minutes of this game, Titus will not stop talking about food. You know, even longer than 20 minutes, but he's very food focused for quite a while.
Yeah, like, you have to find some grasses and set fire. I totally forgot about this. Like,
me too.
I thought that you just woke up on the beach in Besaid. But like, this being underwater and being kind of pressed into service by the Albed completely eliminated that from my memory.
Well, yeah, this is like the first of like five times where Tidus has to wake up face down in water.
Just showing off.
Yeah.
Like if I could breathe underwater, I would sleep in my bathtub just so people would freak out. Like I'd be like a cool Halloween decoration.
Okay. So you know? With this godlike power, what you would do is make your friends and relatives concerned.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And neighbor and visiting Halloween kids.
Ooh.
You know, I'd really spook them.
You could put David Blaine out of business.
Yeah. Yeah, which I would love to do. Fuck that guy.
Well, if Tidus slept face down in the water, you wouldn't get all those sweet snoring nap scenes during the game that are reoccurring for some unnecessary reason.
We do see a lot of real time sleep in this. That's an RTS. We wake up in this encounter, and this opening I think is actually really good and pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. To my mind, the pacing at this point now will slow down to what I consider to be very slow. But I agree with people who do like the pacing of this, that the intro is actually very cool and fast paced and sets the tone really well.
Yeah.
Well, and this first area is also where you're first introduced to treasure chests, and as somebody who, like you guys said, it's not really an open area, but the treasure chests give you a reason to try to search every nook and cranny.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You poke in the corners and stuff, and that's going to be rewarded throughout the game.
Yeah.
And like it is a very linear game, but it does have little diverticula that have little dead ends with nuggets in them.
That's something that's really cool about the 3D environments and a moving camera. Like you have to kind of be on the lookout because they will do clever stuff with hiding chests behind scenery that you have to kind of just notice if you walk by it.
The camera will pan over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Saying it. So in this temple, you kind of have this little task. You have to find flint and tinder to warm up, and then you need food. he keeps having.
Tidus does everything short of just like rub his tummy and go, "Me so hungry."
Yeah, he just pulls out his empty pockets and stuff. Yeah. Like he just communicates in like hobo speak.
Yeah.
You know, like 1920s movie hobo.
Yeah, he just builds a table and bangs on it with his fork and knife.
With a fork and knife. Yeah. Like the
puts on an asymmetrical bib.
It's like they had like a note about him, and it's like, how do we describe our character? Well, he's hungry, and then that was it for a long time. They're like, no, you idiots, he has to be more than hungry. Like he has to go on a journey, and then he stops being hungry like a couple hours in. Mm-hmm. We get a flashback to Oron berating him again, like it's like you're such a crybaby, like it's that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And by making fun of how terrible Jekt is, I don't want to like downplay, like Jekt was a really, really bad dad, and that leads to some really good emotional payoff at the end. Like Tidus, for as much as he is a famous star, had a really rough childhood.
Yep. And largely because of these like bullying man figures in his life made him feel bad for crying and expressing emotions.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sympathetic to that. Like what it resulted is like, I don't like Tidus very much. Mm-hmm. I think he's too dumb as a main character.
Yeah.
And he drives me nuts a little bit because of that, but the actual like victimhood of him, I buy, like, he was treated poorly.
Mm-hmm.
We fight this mantis enemy, this, click pops up. And as we're fighting him, these soldiers burst through the door. Rico is there, and she joins your party very briefly here, which is kind of interesting. She doesn't actually join until way, way later. And she has grenades. She has this item command where she can steal grenades and toss them.
Yeah.
And it's doing this tutorial that for like way, way later in the game.
Yeah. Something that's neat about these soldiers is they are Albed. They're from a different culture. They don't speak English.
They speak a cipher.
Yes.
Nobody tell.
Yeah, it's not like a Caesar cipher, but you find these books that will like translate the subtitles for you. But right now, you know, Tidus has woken up in a strange, hostile world with no food, and there are people pointing guns at him, and he cannot understand them.
Yep. Yeah, which is again a cool setup. Yeah, they knock him out.
Yeah, and you wake up, and you're pressed into service on their salvage ship.
Yep. You go around saying you're so hungry, but nobody cares. And Rico will speak to you. She speaks English, and says, hey, if you work for us, we're not going to execute you. Like, we'll keep you around.
Mm-hmm.
We're called the Albed. And when you're like, where's Xanarkand? she's like, oh, you know, Xanarkand was destroyed 1,000 years ago. Yeah. And that introduces the kind of mystery of this. Like,
tell him Large Marge sent you. Yeah,
exactly. This introduces this idea of syntoxin, which is weirdly underdeveloped in this game. Like late in the end of the game, we just ride around on Sin. We jump inside Sin. Like nobody cares about Sin Toxin. It's just there as this excuse to like to give you a cover for your, you know, for the weird things you say.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't actually play into the plot. Like, I was expecting this to be like the sickness in Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit more. I can't remember what it's called. But, like, when the people got too much Mako and they got sick, and it was going to play into the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of doesn't.
No, you're right. Actually, after about probably 2 or 3 hours into the game, I don't think you ever even hear it again.
Yep. It doesn't happen. And when Sin attacks, it doesn't do anything. Like, Sin actually goes and wipes out an army on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And I was expecting, like, oh, the survivors are going to have this toxin. But no, the survivors are all pretty much fine.
No,
like,
it's a plot. It's a plot device to kind of paper over the fact that Tidus doesn't belong here. Yep. And also to kind of establish him as this viewpoint character who everybody will explain Spira culture and cosmology to.
Yep. So the Elbed, the service they put you in is going to this technological ruin. You dive down into this technological ruin, do a little bit of like the swimming in this game. Like, there are some areas where you have the full Z axis. You fight a creature called a Tross, who introduces trigger commands, which are the context sensitive commands you can have in a battle that are specific to that battle. And there are a lot more of these than I thought there were,
yeah.
Than I remembered. And this allows you to kind of maneuver around this creature and get positioning. Generally, the bosses you fight in this game have a strong gimmick to them,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that the series doesn't always do really well. And I think this entry does really well, actually.
Yeah.
So
it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both right before and after this battle is one of the tropes that I hate, which is where Tidus bangs on a machine and it makes it work.
Yep. He's got that Xanarkin touch.
Yeah. He's
the Fonz.
Yep. Exactly.
Least Fonzie person I've ever met. Like, there's nobody less Fonzie, like, we, you know, in the entire world, and he can do it.
Well, no, they transplanted the Fonz's fist onto him.
Yeah. It's like a snake's hair. Like, I got a transplant from a famous Fonz, and now I have his coolness under the full moon.
So, you know, Tidus talks to Riku a little bit more and says, hey, I'm a Blitzball player. You guys have Blitzball too. Awesome. She says, hey, we'll take you to Luca. It's a Blitzball town. It's like a, you know, Pittsburgh or whatever. You know, we can see if you recognize anybody there. We can figure this out. And she says, hey, don't go talking about Xanarkand, because Yevon says it's a holy place. And this introduces kind of the overriding, let's say, atmospheric antagonist of this world, the Church of Yevon.
Yes. Yeah. Which for a long time is not portrayed as antagonistic until Seymour shows up with his spooky music.
Yeah.
Like, Yevon is not foreboding, really.
Yeah.
Like, it just kind of, it's kind of fine. Like, the Elbed are skeptical of it, but when you run into, you know, most of your friend characters are Yevonites for most of this game. So you're kind of lured in this sense of trusting. And that's just a weird, like, when we get to final summations, like, in a week, like, we'll talk about that. But it's one of the things I think about that's really weird in this game is that it starts off feeling like a game that is about the perniciousness and the kind of harm of organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
And then becomes about something else, like when it actually does its kind of big swings and reveals.
Yeah.
But initially, it feels like it's setting up a game that's about that.
Right.
And I don't think that pays off. It's really weird that, like, the weirdest comparison I have is to a game we're doing in a couple of weeks, which is Bioshock Infinite, which I think does a very similar thing. Like, it has the thing it really wants to be about, but it sets up a opening kind of gambit with it. And this is the opening gambit for it, is this whole thing about the Church of Yevon.
Yes.
So Sin attacks, they're on the boat, Sin attacks them and pulls Tidus overboard. And this is where he wakes up on the beach.
Yes. Wakes up kind of as far from Xanarkand as he can be, off of the coast of the Isle of Besaid. And I think he's actually woken up by being hit on the head by a Blitzball. So subtle.
Yep. This is Waka on the beach, he's like, hey, give us, a little help. And he returns the Blitzball with this flashy kick.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, whoa, you look like a good Blitzballer. Do you want to join our team? And we'll go. And he's like, yes.
It's all I know how to do.
It happens pretty quickly. Like, I've been waiting. I got teleported to this weird world. I've been waiting for someone to ask me to join a sports team. And it finally happened.
I don't know. Like, if I got hit over the back of the head and I woke up on an alien planet and I found out they had podcasting, I don't know. I'd probably do it.
I wouldn't. I think I'd have greater concerns, Cole. I think I'd be like, wait, what? Like,
I think
no.
I think it'd be comforting.
I would not be comforted by it.
Do it. You know, you do it while you're searching for your way home. But
I don't know. I think I'd feel weird about it. I don't think I'd do it. Yeah. Try to find like I need some food.
I got, but let's not forget, I mean Riku just told Tidus, don't mention anything about Xanarkand, and the first question that he answers to Waka is he's from Xanarkand.
Yeah, that's the thing with Tidus, is that like I get that. So what they're trying to do with him, and like once you get to the end and you see this with the narrator voice when it pops in, is they want to show growth. Mm-hmm. I just think they way overcorrected in making him like a whiny idiot.
Yeah.
For most of the game. So like, yes, he gets to a place that's more reasonable. You didn't have to set him back quite so far though. You know, so like, you're right. Like, it's just like, hey, don't say Xanarkand. Xanarkand. Oh shit. You know, like, I just said it. Like, and he just does that constantly. And the biggest thing for me, and this, it starts here when Waka is starting the exposition train, is the, what's a this? And it's a generalized noun that you could figure out from context clues. Like, I understand that it's a general noun that means something specific in this world, but there's a part where he introduces a summoner, and he's like, summoners have guardians, yeah? And he's like, what's a guardian? And like, I just know what a guardian of a thing is. Like, if a can of soda has a guardian, I know what that guardian is doing in relation to that can of soda. You know, I just feel like he doesn't know what words mean, and it just like ends up being very hair pulley to me.
Yeah.
And every time he opens his mouth.
It's strange how selective that is too, because like the few times where he does make an assumption about where things work and doesn't ask somebody to reiterate what it is, it actually ends up being like, oh, you definitely shouldn't have assumed the way something works, because it ends up being a huge emotional reveal.
Yeah. It's just this weird, like they just could have done it. Just revealed it better, and not have maybe not been so guileless in asking. He's incapable of feeling embarrassment or recognizing how weird his situation is for other people. Mm-hmm. You know, like if he had just been like, hey, like I know this is weird, but like what does a guardian do? Like what does that entail?
Yeah,
you know, he could say it in a different way, and they couldn't do that because they were very limited.
Yeah,
another thing, but it just makes him like that's exactly what it is. He has no regard for how weird his situation is for anyone else.
Right.
You know, so he comes off as really sociopathic.
Matt, so you said you know, your love of time travel kind of played into this, you know, the idea that he was thrown 1,000 years forward into, you know, kind of what must seem to him to be this post-apocalypse, like the man being out of time. Like, how does Tidus's treatment of that trope work for you?
I think, I don't think it works out well the way that he reacts to it. Like you guys said, it seems like he's playing just dumb. And I think that they sold that too hard, even if he got moved 1,000 years into the future, he should know what a guardian is or a summoner is. He should know all those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm totally with you. Like, and some of the stuff with the out of timeness does work a little bit better in certain situations, like later. And then eventually they start playing with it too. Mm-hmm. Like he'll just be like, this is probably one of those things where I shouldn't ask. And they'll be like, yeah, like his companions become aware of it and stuff. It just happens very slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? The one aspect I like is that when he finally does, like when he sees a blitzball, you see him light up because it's like the one normal thing to him.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. This weird Katamari.
I would love to play with a blitzball too. It looks like a very pleasing volleyball.
To me. To Etsy.
And immediately, Waka is real cuddly with Tidus. And this ends up making sense. There's an explanation for this. Because he looks like somebody from Waka's past. Even though when we meet that guy, he does not look like him. So Waka, when he says Xanarkand, Waka says, like, actually, Xanarkand was destroyed by Sin long ago, along with all the other technological cities, in order to reset civilization, essentially.
Yeah, to atone for our sins.
Yep. And so we called it Sin. I mean, yes, we know we should have called it something different, so it'd be less confusing, but... too late now.
But we're square and we're gearing up for Final Fantasy 13, where everything is a proper noun.
Everything is a proper noun and everything is a hallway. Like, this is our dry run, yeah?
Yeah.
So Tidus figures if he can find Sin, he can go home. And that makes sense.
Right.
We go to this village with this great music theme. We do some random encounters on the way. And we're introduced that Waka can go underwater as well, mm-hmm. which will come up later for some encounters. We meet these characters called the Crusaders, who are essentially the army that fights Sin.
Right. So they can never defeat Sin, which Tidus is very frustrated by, but they will intercept him and drive him away from civilization centers.
Yes. And they teach him, Waka teaches you this prayer to Yevon, which you know because the blitzball sign for victory,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of interesting. And it's not like a payoff, but once you know everything and that happens, like it actually is kind of neat
mm-hmm.
that they did this. So you go visit the Crusaders. You eventually go to sleep after you checked out the village. And you have this dream about Jack going missing the night that he went off to get some cigarettes and never came back. And when you wake up, you go to the temple where you find Waka.
Yes. And he is standing outside this temple. He is a guardian for this young apprentice summoner who is in here and has been there for way too long.
Yeah.
Titus does not care about their rules and their religion. So he is going to go charge in head first.
Yep. Yeah. And there's a lot of just like, you know, Waka is very pious.
Yes.
Like this is, you know, he's just like, oh, it's forbidden. You can't do that. And he just does it anyway because he doesn't care.
Yeah.
And you go into your first cloister of trials. I'll be curious as to what, like, I really don't like these. I think that they're very frustrating and they're pacing killers and they're bad as far as puzzles go. Uniformly, I don't think any of them are good. And I remember liking them. They're not a big deal. Like, you can, if you know the solution, you can scoot through them in a reasonable amount of time. But I think that the way that these puzzles work is like, really trial and error. Like you get proper noun spheres and you just have to see what happens when you put them in certain slots and they don't feel like there's leaps of intuition to be made in them. And I really kind of uniformly do not like these. I'd be curious as to what you guys think about the trials.
I'm with you. I'm not a big fan. And I think the other thing that's funny is it's like, you carry around these spheres and Titus can only carry one at a time for some reason.
It ends up being a huge interface tax. Like the animation and the, like just going back and literally doing the, you know, the fox and the chicken and the bag of grain crossing the river
mm-hmm.
Kind of constantly.
Yeah. That interface tax and the fact that you're kind of doing this weirdly in the dialogue system, like deciding whether to pick something up or place it. Kind of discourages exploration that, and just, this doesn't really seem like an engine where you're supposed to push stuff around.
When you end
up having to push stuff around, it just, they kind of like, I'm down for the idea of a puzzle, even if it's simplistic, you know, but there's so much friction there that it feels unsatisfying. And also once you realize the twist for most of these, which is different slots can have multiple functions, and sometimes the answer is to put a sphere in, take it out, and then put a different sphere in behind it. Mm-hmm. Then most of them shake out.
I'm glad that you brought up pushing things, because like what Resident Evil games do, they're very clever. Like in most games where they have block pushing, is they lock you to grid,
yeah,
like onto a thing, and you just kind of get locked to that object and move them both over. But this doesn't really do that quite as well. As other games do. So it does feel very bad to push things around, like the block puzzle aspects of it.
Yeah.
I feel like I cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, this cloister trial isn't so bad, but once you start getting towards the ones later on in the game where they can take you like 45 minutes to complete, it's a pain. Yep.
Yeah.
The conveyor belt one, man.
Oof.
Well, and also these ruin immersion for me. Like mm-hmm. this is what you have to do. To if you're a religious leader
mm-hmm.
in this world, like this kind of like, you know, block puzzle, pushing things in slots stuff.
Yeah.
Like that's just ridiculous. Like it feels like it kills the tone. It's very weird.
Yeah.
And Final Fantasies never really have puzzles like this.
No.
And it's just an attempt at doing it. And I just think it is like an abject failure. Like I didn't want just another dungeon, like just a combat trial would be silly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I wanted instead of this, but every time one of these came up, I was really bummed.
Yeah.
I think they're pretty bad.
Before you can become Pope, you need to solve this shape sorter.
Yeah. Yeah. Before you can become Pope, try these different spheres in these different slots and see if one of them opens the way. You know, now you're Pope.
Yes.
And congratulations, now you die. it's a weird religion. So we're not going to talk about all these in detail just because they are pretty tedious. They end up having like a concept to them, sort of,
yeah.
That's roughly tied to an element.
Yeah.
That is roughly tied to the Aeon you get from them.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's weird too that the idea, some of these canonically Yuna goes through on her own, but it's always just Titus doing them
mm-hmm.
on his own. You know, so it's just kind of weird. Like, I would like it if you switched to Yuna for these too. And it was like about her kind of mastery, but instead it just ends up being Titus. Like it's just very strange.
That's a good point. You do play as Yuna at a for a very short period of time in this game, but this would have been a good opportunity to switch that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, spend some time with her and spend some time with her like strengths. You know, like that would have positioned them as different, as opposed to having Tidus be this weird polymath, which we know he's not.
Right.
Have, you know, Tidus is the kind of dumb jock who has a heart of gold, and Yuna's a little bit smarter and more considered. And you could have had this like expression of that character through play, and they missed that opportunity, I think.
Yeah. So you get through that, and Waka joins you kind of in the vestibule outside of the Chamber of the Faith, F-A-Y-T-H. Mm-hmm. Those are very specific things. They're statues that the summoners pray to. The statues actually that are bodies of people who have been turned into kind of this locus of power. He says, hey, guardians are supposed to protect these apprentice summoners on their pilgrimage, you know, to go and pray at every temple to Spira, in Spira rather. And yep. This kind of sets up the structure for the first half of the game where we are moving from town to town.
Yep. When you actually get into this chamber, you meet our next two guardians and party members, Kamari and Lulu. You know, Lulu is a tall goth girl.
Mm-hmm.
She's a black mage. The only, like, I think she looks cool other than the fact that she's just got a unreasonable amount of cleavage.
Yeah.
And that's like the cheesecake is the one bummer, but I do think that as far as fashion goes, like, she looks okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Kamari, I guess, looks okay too. He just looks like he's very much like a proud warrior.
Yeah,
like kind of thing.
Tribal warrior kind of deal. I like Kamari's broken horn. Actually, yeah. I think that's a cool design element. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lulu works for me as well. I wish that A, she wasn't so booby, and the camera wasn't fixated on that.
There's some boob cam in this game that's kind of like a little egregious from time to time.
Yeah, but de rigueur. You know, I didn't expect any better. I like Lulu's characterization because she's been around the block a few times in terms of being a guardian, and she's mm-hmm. failed before. Yeah. So she provides like this really good grounded voice of reason a lot of the time. That is refreshing that not everybody is, you know, wet behind the ears.
Yep. In general. And she's a foil to Waka. They're two kind of joined at the hip.
Yeah.
And they're meant to be kind of, you know, Waka is this dumb racist jock and Lulu is a little bit wiser and more cynical.
Yeah.
The one thing is like, if you look at Lulu's stats and stuff, like she's 22, which uh-huh. I think is a real mistake. I mean,
but that's a thing. Like, what was it? Cecil was the commander of the Red Wings by 19 or something like that.
Yeah. Unnecessary to do that. Yeah. You know, or on at the ripe old age of 25 as the elder statesman, you know, it just like, but yeah, so she's cool. I like her character as well.
Yeah.
You know, and as we mentioned, she's a black mage, and really weirdly, like she will be your powerhouse in my experience, at least like very key to the first half of this game. Like Absolutely. She fell off in usefulness, mm-hmm. Near the end when the rest of my party members were a lot stronger, but she ends up being extremely essential.
Yeah. Her trade-off is that her overdrive isn't really any great shakes.
Yeah, and she's also slow.
Yeah.
Her general movement speed, like some of it is casting time, but also she is one of the slower people
mm-hmm.
on the, yeah. So when she filled out her sphere grid, I moved her over to Tidus just to get some speed.
Oh, yeah.
And have her move a little bit quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So as you meet these characters, Yuna appears. She comes out of this inner chamber and she nearly falls over exhausted. She is now a summoner and she is following in the steps of her father, Lord Braska. Who we eventually find out Lord Braska was the last person to succeed, quote unquote, in this endeavor.
Right. 10 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah. So she goes outside and summons Vaelphor, her first Aeon, to the delight of everybody. We can talk about the different combat gimmicks for these people on the Leaving Besaid section, just because that's where we get the tutorials for them. But it's a, you know, big, spectacular thing. Vaelphor comes down, she gives him head scratches. It's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a little pupper without arms. He's got weird little like snails instead of arms.
like a little brother?
Yeah, he's got little brothers. The Tidus talks to Yuna for the first time. This is going to be a romance, you know, so it is. And she, you know, Tidus's opening line to anyone is, I'm from Xanarkand. she immediately, like, she's curious about Xanarkand. Like, so what do you mean by that? In a very like, bless your heart. So she wants to know about it. And later when you go to sleep before leaving the village, you have this dream about Yuna and Riku.
Yeah.
And Jekt appears to badmouth you about crying.
I think Lulu shows up. So like this is very weirdly like a love triangle, like frustrated sex dream that feels out of
later
context.
On. You can mac on Lulu
mm-hmm.
Later on in the game, which is really weird.
Yeah.
To me, because she doesn't like, come on, your pants are different lengths. Like, she's out of your league, buddy. You didn't put on the right pants. You put on two kinds of the wrong pants.
Yep.
Your pants have one belt. What's that all about?
Yeah, she's very, like, you can tell what she likes.
Yeah.
If this is the Dragon Age, you just give her belts and chopsticks for her hair and cute little dolls.
Yeah. Oh, so, man, I love that she fights with dolls.
I like that, too. I think that's so awesome. Good. Very cool. So you wake up and you eavesdrop, like you go and you listen to Lulu talking about how Titus looks like somebody named Chapu.
Yeah.
And it turns out that Chapu was Waka's younger brother. He was a crusader who died. And that's why Waka's been so weirdly touchy with you, immediately putting you in a headlock, like as soon as he sees you and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. You are the second coming of Chapu.
Waka lacks object permanence. like a way that like doesn't quite work. So. You're getting ready to leave Basay, and this is the first time you're kind of in the morning. Waka gives Titus Chapu's old sword, and you are now you're not officially a guardian, but you're pretty much a guardian.
Yeah,
escorting Yuna on her pilgrimage, because you're still going to go to the area to check out Blitzball and see if you have any friends. But that's where we're going to take you.
Yeah,
to the town. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, so this is the longest sustained section of combat tutorials, kind of teaching you the different uses for the people that you have. Kamari's not with you yet, but kind of the overall idea is Waka, because he fights by throwing a blitzball, he will take out flying enemies. You fight flan enemies here, so mm-hmm. Yuna can cast, or not Yuna, Lulu can cast at them. And eventually, like, you learn that there are these kind of mini boss enemies, you know, big high HP enemies that are explicitly here. They call for Yuna to summon and fight.
Yep. Summon in Velaphor. Velaphor has a couple spells and has a general attack that delays enemies. So, again, showing you that kind of right away. That you're going to be messing with the timeline there. A little bit further in, you get Kamari. You get attacked by Kamari,
mm-hmm.
And you learn that he is on your side. And his whole thing is that he's the blue mage. He's learned to fight the way that the fiends do. The way this works mechanically is you use an attack called Lancet, and you can learn enemies' moves from that. And then when you have an overdrive, you can do those moves, and it's most of the game before you get any that are worth it.
Yeah.
And you have to have an overdrive built up. And he's the diet version of everyone else in your party.
Yeah.
Anyone else in your party, not everyone. That would be an interesting way to do it, too, if he just had, you know, all, like, if he was, like, a mimic. Like, he had all the abilities of everyone else, but did them at a lower level.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he didn't even go on the sphere grid. Like, it just happened.
Yeah.
But he could do the things. He's just a little bit worse. But as it is, you commit to making him a worse version of someone and then never using him.
I can kind of see what they're trying to do, because in the past, blue magic, you know, especially in, let's say, like Final Fantasy VII or, you know, Final Fantasy VI, has been very overpowered. Things like Mighty Guard or White Wind end up being these awesome combination spells that will give you a huge leg up. By making those more expensive in terms of time, you know, like they only fire off so often because of the overdrive meter, I get that as a balancing thing, but it makes it really hard to plan for or work that into a general strategy.
Well, and just they make him not very good on top of that.
Yeah.
Like, he's just a weaker version of another character. So, like, it's almost, if he could have been, like, blue magic in the past has always worked best when it's paired with something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in Final Fantasy V, you don't make just a straight up blue mage. And in VII, you always have the enemy skill materia on top of other materia on top of another character. Like, he could have almost been the fighter character if there wasn't Auron.
Right.
You know, and could do blue magic every once in a while, and that would work. But as such, he just doesn't have a place in the party.
Oh, Kamari's other thing, he's the first character that you get that has piercing weapons. So you would bring him in to fight armored people. Eventually,
until you get Auron.
Yeah, eventually Auron supplants that because he's just better. But yeah.
Yeah. Yep, yep. So you end up going, you get on the ship to go to Kalika. And on the ship, Yuna says, you know, actually, I know about Xanarkand. I've heard about it from Jekt, who is her father's guardian.
Mm-hmm.
And the dates line up for her Jekt to be the same as your Jekt. So, hey, I know your dad.
Yeah. Okay. So we can actually work on this. We the pieces of the mystery are being slowly meted out.
Yep.
Yeah. Of course, because you're on a boat, Sin attacks. Mm-hmm. This knocks Yuna overboard. And we get Waka and Titus fighting alongside each other. First fighting this Sin Fin up top, and then going down to fight this jellyfish that has taken Yuna hostage.
Yep. So jellyfish takes Yuna hostage. and then we fight it. Along, and there are also some of those scales fall down that will kind of kamikaze during this fight.
What do we think of these times where it kind of forces you into a particular party composition first?
Like water party?
Yeah. Yeah. Your swimming party first with Waka and Tidus, and then later adding Riku onto this. Like, is that a decision that works for us, or is that something we could do without?
What do you think, Matt?
I like it because I usually in the other battles, I didn't use Riku or Waka very often. So these underwater areas kind of force that and it kind of helped them balance along the sphere grid for me.
No, I don't mind these because I did use a lot of Waka for me. So Waka tended to be pretty leveled and Tidus was pretty leveled. And Riku, was easy to find a place in my party because she could use the Albed potions and stuff.
Yeah.
So she could be a substitute healer. I like it a lot more than the forced Kamari sequence later so I don't mind them that much but I think it's mostly a coincidence. Like I might have minded them if I was really underleveled on some of those characters.
The only time it bugs me is when you end up fighting enemies that have elemental weaknesses and like straight up, like at one point Lulu says, oh, you should probably teach Riku or Waka to cast. I'm like, should I have been doing that? Because none of these people are casters.
Yep. And it would have been easier for them just not to have an elemental weakness thing underwater.
Yeah.
Then just like add that and then have a character like say to have done this. You know, it's just very weird. It's a little sloppy.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, it's definitely weird for a game that is about every character being a specific key.
Yeah.
I'm fighting a bunch of locks. It seems like it would have been easy just to have only the right types of locks underwater.
Yeah.
You know, so limiting your key, it doesn't really necessarily force you to be creative. Like if you couldn't actually jump over to other people's spaces on the sphere grid, maybe that would have been a thing where it's like, hey, learn to use Riku's items more to do elemental damage or something like that. But it just kind of doesn't. Like you can just move anybody over to spells.
Yeah.
So this first battle with Sin, I don't know about you guys, but one of the knocks on this game for me is I don't like that it doesn't have a new game plus or anything like that to make your next go through any easier. Mm-hmm. But this battle is actually one where you can, if you give it enough time, you can level your characters up to where they can kill essentially an infinite amount of the Sin scales with one hit.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you have a turbo controller, you can... basically just set it and forget it and let your characters just kill these Sin scales over and over and over and over again. Mm. And by the end of the matchup, you can actually get all the way up to 99 sphere moves for everybody here at this point in the game.
Holy God.
Wow, he's out. Yeah. And the way that that works in this is some things do scale to you in this game, like some enemies, but not very many.
Right.
Like that Kamari fight scales. But for the most part, that will actually give you a huge, huge leg up on stuff.
Yeah, this part would be where you could kind of create almost a new game plus, because you could very, very early on learn a lot of the abilities that take you, you know, usually 10, 15 hours in to learn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially if you use that for customization, like to make the moves across the board to get where you needed to be, as opposed to using it to become incredibly overpowered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and you could, at that point, you could probably start taking on some of the optional stuff as soon as it becomes available.
Yeah.
Like you won't have any of the end game, like super weapons, but you'll be high enough level to where maybe you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know about that exploit.
Yeah. I was unaware of that.
What Sin does, we didn't really talk about this, but what Sin does is pop up every 10 years and just destroy cities. Like it just, you know, destroy cities. Mm-hmm. And we have just led Sin to Kalika.
Yeah.
Who pops up and destroys it.
Yeah. He just completely wipes out an entire populated area.
Yeah.
Which leads to one of the things about this that I wanted to kind of just talk about as a generality. This is an incredibly colorful game. You know, especially in comparison to 7 and 8, 9 got a little bit more colorful, but had its own kind of dinginess to it. This is a very bright world where people seem to be, you know, generally fine in their tropical paradises or whatever. But it is a bleak game in terms of like what is actually portrayed.
Yeah, well, it's very serious.
Yeah.
Like it's a very serious game, which is one of the things that ends up being for me a contrast in tone that I don't like.
Mm.
So like, you know, Tidus being such an idiot and being so focused on like him so hungry or just saying blitzball at inopportune times. And at any given time during this game, you're in the wake of a Holocaust,
yeah.
You know, and it is very bleak in what happens, but like when characters are idiots or when people don't act like there's stakes at that, like it feels to me like it's in contrast, you know, it doesn't fit very well. Like we're coming up on like the infamous laughing scene and like the defense of that laughing scene. And I'm not, you know, that people have is that like, this is supposed to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yes, gallows humor is a thing.
Yeah.
Like you can make jokes when you're in this, but the game just doesn't have a tone where it feels like these characters are having very much fun.
Yeah.
You know, or should be having very much fun for the most part.
It feels like they missed an opportunity. I hate to say missed a spot to a, you know, to a game developer. If I hated it, I wouldn't do it as much as I do. Anyway, they missed an opportunity. Tidus as the fish out of water, coming to this and seeing how blasé everybody is about just how expendable life is in Spira. Mm-hmm. like that would be the posture, because if I walked in,
that would
be
very funny.
Yeah,
you know, if he was just like, wait a minute, like if he just couldn't get over Kalika being destroyed.
Yeah.
As opposed to instantly getting over it.
Yeah,
like everyone does, like we do descending and now no one will say Kalika again.
Yep.
Like once the city has been wiped off the map by Sin, we no longer talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, he does eventually kind of get to that point. I mean, he has some internal dialogue where he says, you know, people die, Yuna dances.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
I think he does eventually get there. But you're right. I think that they're a little late to the game on it.
Yeah. The breaking point is the Mihen operation. Yeah. I think.
Well, and there is an element to what they're trying to do is that like the people of Spira are overly resigned
yeah
to this as reality, and that's why they accept their super shitty solution for it.
Yeah,
like, and that is part of the game, but it is just really weird that like getting resigned to cataclysm level events every 10 years doesn't feel very real to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a thing.
Yeah, they're just so habituated to it because it's all part of the ritual.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know. And then yeah, so it's like that makes a kind of sense. It is just really weird. And it's weird that Tidus is also just kind of like, okay, you know, eventually gets there. But yeah,
everybody does. All right. Until he gets to everybody, you know, people died. Yuna dances.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Yuna dances.
Mm-hmm.
This ends up becoming a weirdly plot important thing. Yuna comes up to Kalika and performs ascending. So a summoner can perform ascending, which dances and all these little, pyreflies. Pop out and go to this thing called the Far Plane.
Right.
Which is the afterlife.
If somebody is not sent, then they rise up as an unsent. Or in the Japanese, I think it's like just straight up corpse. Like instead of unsent, it's a corpse. And they, you know, risk becoming a fiend.
Yep.
You know, because
a fiend being a monster.
Yeah. So, you know, you race up there, you know, the city is destroyed or the town is destroyed, but there's still stuff to do. Like you find Sinspawn Jinno. Which is another fight here that has a wrinkle. It's shielded at first, but also there are these two tentacles behind you, a little bit like Ruby Weapon, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you once you get through this, and this we say we race up, like this is like you're having a fun foot race at this point too. Like the shaking off the Holocaust happens immediately.
Yeah.
After this, after you dispense with this boss, which is not like a whole lot to this boss. There are gimmick bosses in this; they're a lot stronger than this one.
Mm-hmm.
He spends with this one. Waka starts getting kind of curious about Xanarkand. Like you got the impression up until this point that he didn't really believe you.
Mm-hmm.
But he's starting to believe you, and it's because he wants to. He's like, you know, maybe Sin doesn't actually kill people if it didn't kill you. Maybe it sends them through time. And Lulu's like, nope, that's not what happened to Chapu. Chapu's dead.
Yeah.
He's never coming back. He won't be replaced.
She gets even more like graphic about it too. Like she says, Chapu wasn't sucked up. He was smeared across that beach.
Yeah. And this is good and like a good character moment. It is a little bit undercut by the fact that they could just go talk to Chapu whenever they want.
Yeah.
Like the afterlife is just through a gate in this world. You know, you just go there.
It's like somebody moving across the country. Like you still have a phone.
Yeah. Like, you know, like somebody moved to Providence, Rhode Island. They didn't get smeared across a beach.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just a little weird that he thinks like maybe this is what happens to creatures. They go through Sin when in fact, you know what happened to him.
Yeah.
Like go to Guadalajara and check him out. Like. So it's a little bit weird, but it's a good character moment for Lulu. And Lulu's invested in Chapu as well, because they were lovers, which we'll find out.
They were engaged is the thing. So, yeah, this is where, you know, after this fight, like when we're going to the temple, we meet a couple of
time to meet some jerks,
time to meet some snobs in contrast to our slobs. We meet the Luca goers. I think that the I think that the team names for all the Blitzball teams are uniformly ridiculous.
Goer is like, how can you be the highest one if you are a goer, like, you know, the toughest one. Arox is fine, like that's a beast,
yes,
you know.
Yeah,
but and Kalika beast okay as well.
The Abes, come on.
Yeah, Abes,
the Albed Sykes.
Yep,
Sykes.
not the Sykes, the Sykes.
Sykes. Yeah, the guys in the Luca goers are the weird rich kids from across the lake.
Yeah, it is weirdly Snobs versus Slavs, because they make fun of the Albed Aurochs because they've never won.
Not Albed, the Besaid.
Oh, Besaid, sorry. I get these mixed up. They make fun of the Besaid team because they've never won. They're the Cleveland Browns of Blitzball.
Yep.
This other summoner named Donna makes fun of Yuna for having so many for rolling so deep.
When she just has one gigantic weird muscle numbskull.
Yeah.
Like, I can't remember. What's the guy's name?
It's like
Barthello.
Barthello. Yeah.
Barthello is very funny to me.
I like Barthello. Like,
the way they make his face, like, he just always looks like he's like working on a math problem or something. Like, everybody doesn't really know what math is. Like, he's trying to spell a math problem.
Uh-huh.
Or something like that. Like, he just always. Sweet
bowl cut.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like bowl cut and kind of furrowed brow all the time. It is very funny to me. Well, just get yourself a Barthello. One Barthello is equal to all of you guys.
Yeah. But you know, explains like, oh, the more friends you have, the merrier. Like, I get to share this joy with everybody.
Yep. As you go into the cloister of trials, or as Yuna does and the guardians do, mm-hmm. you hang out behind. You're just like waiting, and then Barthello picks you up and throws you onto the elevator, which I guess is supposed to like disgrace you. Or something.
Well, I mean, like, so they're committing a horrible sin, breaking the precepts and hoping to get Yuna excommunicated, which is a fucking dick move.
Well, it's a super dick move, but then it's like, I already did this.
Yeah.
Like, I just go into them and nobody actually seems to care. Like, when I come out, some guy kind of chides me a little bit, but it really doesn't matter, guys.
Yeah.
You know, I can do this all day. But just an excuse for the player to do the sphere trial.
Yes.
Right before this with Barthello, is you have this weird moment where Yuna starts talking about how kind and gentle Jekt is, or Jekt was. And it's kind of awkward because, like you said, he was kind of a deadbeat dad, but the way that Yuna portrays him is 100% different.
Yeah.
And you're not really buying it. Like, whenever he comes up, he just gets really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, about it, and just kind of like, we'll brush it off, or just be like, that wasn't my old man.
Mm-hmm.
He always still was an old man. One of the things, a gimmick that we didn't talk about with these trials is the destruction spheres.
Yeah.
So there's an optional, like, as much as anything's a puzzle in this game, like an optional puzzle to do get this treasure. You want to be doing those for the end game.
Yeah.
We mentioned that in the generalities, but just know that, like, you're just doing kind of pretty boilerplate temple trial stuff here, but you want to do the extra stuff while you're here, and you get a little trinket for doing it. You get an item.
Yeah. The reason you want to do all those is it unlocks one of the best, Eidolon's in the game. Yep. Unlocks Anima.
This trial is basically is around fire and lighting things on fire, but no great shakes. When you eventually meet up with your party again after going through it, Lulu explains that the Faith are souls of people who gave their lives to fight sin. You haven't took their souls and trapped them in statues. Cool. And when summoners pray to them, they emerge as aeons.
Right.
So it's Yuna comes out with your next summon, which is Ifrit.
Yeah. It's specifically like whatever they dream of is the monster that comes out. Ifrit, he's our good old buddy. He's got fire attacks. His overdrive is really powerful. It'll do a bunch of damage. And his main attack is just a bunch of damage to, I think, the entire field of enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has a multi-attack. And his weird meteor thing is actually non-elemental, which can be very useful for things.
Yeah.
So as you leave, all these worshippers are hanging out because Yuna is a bit of a celebrity.
Yeah.
And you make this comparison. Since she's Lord Braska's daughter and she's going on this pilgrimage, everyone has great expectations for her. Tita starts thinking about Xanarkand, or just idly saying Xanarkand out loud to bait somebody into asking him about it, because he's that guy.
My other city is also Xanarkand.
Yeah. My Xanarkand is an honor student.
Yeah.
So Yuna says, like, what, you know, how are you feeling? And he's like, I just want to scream real loud. Mm-hmm. And then he does his little scream.
Ah, yeah. This is something I wish that they dug in on a little bit more. I understand that Final Fantasy stories don't necessarily dwell in this kind of personal aspect, but the idea of being the child of a celebrity and trying to, like, either live up to them or, you know, again, walk in their footsteps, that is interesting to me.
Yeah. I would say it's underexplored here, though. Like, there's a parallel, but it ends up not being really what it ends up being about.
Yeah.
Like, it's definitely a cause for resentment for Tidus.
Mm-hmm.
But if that was the only thing Jekt did, like, if he was wrong about Jekt,
mm-hmm.
you know, that would be kind of cool and would make their reconciliation at the end a little bit more meaningful.
Right.
You know, it's just like, actually, I just misunderstood my old man. Like, he was not a monster. I was jealous of him. I lived in his shadow. I resented him. He wasn't just, like, constantly bullying me.
Yeah, no, he did, like, you know? He was a bully, and Jekt did grow up and mature when he was in Spira, because pressure was placed on him, you know.
Yeah.
That wasn't just playing good. Yeah.
Yeah. And the stuff with Yuna, like, Yuna is a very frustrating character to me in general, because I actually like her arc and where she ends up. The arc of her getting disillusioned with the church, I think, is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff with her and her father's footstep doesn't actually get paid off on. And I think of that as a symptom of this game having those kind of A side and B side. Like, the first half about being about the church. And it's like, well, this church, you know, the outsider, the player knows that there's something wrong with the religion in this world. And then, it's because it's run by, like, zombies. Like, it's run by amoral zombies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, that's kind of a straw man. Like, of course it's shitty. It's run by monsters.
Yeah.
And then she gets disillusioned with that. But then the stuff with her father doesn't come up too much. And the stuff in the end game about letting go, like, does not play with Yuna other than letting go of Tidus.
Right.
Which then she spends the next game getting back.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of frustration or, like, unrealized potential with that, where it's like playing in the shallow end of a couple different themes without really doing a deep dive on the most, like, the strongest ones, I feel like.
Yeah. I also wish that she wasn't so flat. There's an awful lot of assumed interest in her, specifically because she is played up as a romantic interest.
Yep. You know? She's pretty, and that's, like, the supposed to be the thing. Like, he just falls in plot love with her, and she doesn't really show any kind of, like, real spark or qualities until a little bit into the game.
Yeah.
And part of that is probably them cutting her lines, like, down to size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the voice actress having to kind of, like, rush through some of those deliveries and them sounding a little bit flat.
Yeah.
You know, so some of that's probably a production thing to me.
My guess.
We get on a boat.
Yeah, when you get on the boat, there's a scene at the back of the boat that Yuna gets involved in, where the rival Blitzball team is kind of talking some smack about Tidus, and she decides to chime in, and her defense of him is, well, he used to be the star player of the Xanarkand Abes.
Yeah.
It's like, why? Why?
stop saying that. Like, yeah, I'm from Mesopotamia. Harry, stop saying that. No, I'm from Mesopotamia, though, actually. Yeah, would you shut up?
I am the keymaster.
Yeah, it's very strange, and it can be read as just her supporting her friend,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's like, it's not like there's nothing there. Like, some of the stuff that I'm complaining about, like, it's not that there's not nods to it. I just don't think the execution is done as well as it could be.
Yeah,
you know. That is, like, a scene. I think it's supposed to be just her backing up her buddy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and that is a generous act. Like, you know, the fact that she immediately believes Tidus, right, and doesn't question his sanity, doesn't make him, like, hide behind this sin toxin defense. Like, you can just.
Well, she knows it's fake.
Yeah,
she's the one. She's a biology major, and she actually knows that there's no such thing as sin toxin. That's why no one else ever talks about it.
Right.
You know, it's like grandpa's old cough medicine.
Mm, yeah.
Waka and Lulu talk about leaving you and Luca. Or, like, kind of letting Yuna make you a guardian, but this liminal state's not going to do.
No.
And there's a thing where you find a beach Blitzball on the deck, and you can learn how to try to do this thing called the Jekt shot.
Mm-hmm.
This is so weird. This, like, weird interface change.
Yeah.
For this, and this as a kid, like, this took me as a kid when I was a 21 year old man. This took me
when I could drink.
When I could drink. At the age I could drink, this took me so many tries. To get this, it's not actually that hard, but it seemed like the hardest thing in the world to me.
Mm-hmm.
To get this thing, I got it this time. I could not do it when I was younger.
Yeah.
For the life of me.
Yeah. So what happens is, like, it gives you a tutorial. Tutorial. You have to press in a direction and press X from wherever a memory comes up. Mm-hmm. And the memory is always Ject berating you. So it's Dance Dance Devastation.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. very, very abusive.
Yeah.
So you hit those things and you get this very powerful move for when you play Blitzball.
Right.
Which there'll be some mandatory Blitzball coming up.
Right. So when we arrive in Luka, the announcer gives us a warm welcome by talking about how the Besaid Aurochs really shouldn't have bothered to show up.
It's very cruel. Like, the roasting that goes from just the entire world to them is very strange to me.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the Luka goers are the talk of the town. Because, you know, they're the top team. Mm-hmm. And we also hear that, hey, this is a big deal because the heads of the church are here.
Super Pope.
Yeah, the Super Pope, Maester Micah, has arrived with Maester Seymour, the son of this famous Guado Maester, who has recently taken his place here. And they arrive, and you look at Seymour and you say, oh, yeah, he's a villain.
The design on Seymour, man, that haircut, his weird, like, forward dread.
And it's like an armature of hair that he has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The design on Seymour is very rough to me. I just, that hair is really, and he's a different race. Like, I get that he's like half tree person.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, he makes sense for him to look a little bit different, mm-hmm. but I think they get through that with his weird, like, veiny schlong forehead.
Yeah.
He has, you know, but the hair is really unexcusable to me. Mm-hmm. And when they show him as a kid later, like, I laughed a lot at baby Seymour with his like bad haircut as a kid.
Yeah. we also find out that there's a Sir Oran here, like, Sir Oran, you know, please report to the courtesy phone. And it's pretty much concluded. Yeah, this is the same Oran that we saw at the beginning of the game.
Yeah.
And this is where we get our Blitzball tutorial.
There's a kind of some theming in this tutorial and happened before where the Aurochs have like a good attitude where they're like, we just want to do our best.
Yeah.
And Tidus immediately comes in and goes, that's loser talk. You guys are idiots. You're going to win.
Yeah.
And it's very weird because like it's positioned as correct.
Uh-huh.
And that's what his dad did to him. So it's thematically, it's like character sound.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that's, you can imagine that's something he learned from his dad. Right.
Yeah.
But how is that positioned as the right lesson?
Yeah.
You know, don't try to do your best in this sport. Dominate or die.
Yeah. either win or go home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's like a human Nike. Like, he's a Nike swoosh made manifest. Very weird.
Yeah. there's a little bit more kind of friction here because we also have the Ronso who have showed up at this Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Or Super Orb, I suppose, because it takes place in a big water orb. Kamari, we find out he was like a runt who was cast out of his society because he lost a duel and his horn was broken. Mm-hmm. And while this is happening, while we're doing cat people problems, Lulu says, like, hey, Yuna's been taken hostage by the Albed Sykes. So we either need to throw the match or go rescue her.
Yeah, I it's very funny. Like, a lot of things happen very quickly here. There's a couple other things that, like, this is where the Tidus teaching Yuna to whistle, and, like, if you whistle, I'll come.
Oh, yeah.
Happens as well. Yeah, yeah. Just because there's callbacks to that, like, you know, and that this is where we learn that, like, you know, Tidus says something like, our cities were huge, and she's like, cities can't get huge because every 10 years they get wiped off the map.
Right.
By sin.
Mm-hmm.
But none of the Guardians were doing their job.
No,
like literally all of them were talking about Blitzball or dealing with cat problems or who knows what Lulu was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But Yuna got taken. It's their one thing.
Yeah.
And got kidnapped for this little side thing that's pretty inconsequential. Like this kind of bothers me. This feels like filler.
So it sets up that, like, yeah, the Albed are taking summoners. Like that's a major plot point later that leads to a big revelation. The fact that they just said throw the game and not we are trying to save this person's life undercuts the motivation a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, because this is like an unrelated kidnapping.
No.
It's like the primary Albed verb. Like they haven't met a problem they can't kidnap. you know, so like you go to this dungeon, you fight a bunch of Albed, and you're fighting their mechana, which are just machines.
Yes.
That's just the spirit word for them.
Mm-hmm.
Culminating in a boss battle against a gigantic crane.
Or no, it's like a gigantic gun, but there's a crane in the arena that you can power up with Lulu's thunder spells, and it takes out the machine's battery, which cuts this battle time way, way down if you do it.
Yeah, hold on, you guys. So let's not belittle this enemy you have to fight that just throws blitzballs at you.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, the thing is not a gun. It is a blitzball training.
It's a pitching machine. I forgot about that.
Yeah. You're not down to the family fun park to grind up some XP. You know,
like you're Happy Gilmore?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Like, this is like our summoner, this religious holy person, has been kidnapped. Let's go fight sports equipment. You know, using
like this thing's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
This is very funny. Yeah, you're right. I forgot that that's what that was. Super silly. Getting hit with a blitzball really hurts in this game. It kills things constantly.
Yeah. It poisons them too. Is Waka just slathering poison on the side of these?
It's like a commentary on football. Like, people are getting blinded, you know, from this. Like, it's just like you spend your, you know, if you get in Little League blitzball, like, you end up with a lot of brain damage, and you're gonna end up like Waka. You end up like a weird race, like the slowest guy in the party.
CTE, no CTB.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Well, and then you get the moment afterwards where Lulu, after Yuna finally comes out, and Lulu says, "I hope you didn't hurt them," and then Yuna says, "Only a little."
Yeah. She was fine too.
They fell over and their pyreflies left them. So
yeah. We it's like we keep forgetting that Yuna has Ifrit backing her up, you know, who can take on a bunch of just like random Albed kidnapping sports people.
Mm-hmm.
This is going kind of back and forth between like we're trying to get here in time. Like, while this is happening, Waka is like holding the game, trying to, but they're getting trounced.
Yeah.
They're not doing very well. So you actually come back and you get to play blitzball.
Mm-hmm.
There. And you can win this. It's very difficult too, because you don't know how to play and your team is not good.
Yeah. And by not good, it's not just like, oh, they move around weird. No, their stats are just worse. Like, you know, blitzball is all about
not a reflex game.
Right. It's like checking stats against, you know, like your shoot stat versus the cumulative block stats of all these other people. And just the numbers don't work out for you.
Yep. Like, it is possible. And if you win, nothing really happens.
Right.
You get an extra item, but it doesn't change the story or anything like that. Like,
very much. So I understand the plot reason they did this, right? The Aurochs have to be underdogs. Like, they need to, you know, them going up against Luka is a big deal because it's, you know, like the Browns going against the Patriots or whatever, something like that. However, the fact that it is such a stomping, I think it probably discouraged a lot of people from engaging with the system.
With blitzball?
Yeah,
they're probably like, this is not fun.
Yeah.
You know, because it's to me, like, just a sports RPG was very appealing, you know, at the time. But so I get that. But also, you're right. Like, it's starting you off as an underdog is not a great way to do it.
Yeah.
There. After you get trounced, a bunch of monsters attack the stadium. We'll later find out why this happens. Yeah. And kind of a weird hidden scene. Like, at the end of the, I read about these, I didn't do them, but you can go back near the end of the game and get new dialogue from like all the side characters you're introduced to. Mm-hmm. And this, we find out that ultimately, like, spoiler, Seymour did this.
Oh, yeah.
So Auron joins you in the fight and you get surrounded. It seems like the battle is going to go poorly. And then Seymour, if you didn't already know he was a villain, he summons his summon, which, like, you know, we have a cute bird with snails for arms. Seymour has Anima, who is a Todd McFarlane toy come to life.
Yeah.
Like, Todd McFarlane's Anima comes to life.
Yeah, we get the BDSM monster that appears. I generally like Anima, like, as a design, especially the fact that, like, we mostly only see part of her, and her overdrive is like showing the rest of her as it goes.
Yeah.
And this is a cool badass scene, but yeah, like, it's not exactly subtle in the theming.
No. Like, there's nothing. His villain music came up. Like, he's obvious, so clearly a villain. You know, obviously, but it's just very funny that he also summons like a devil, like a demon, his weird demon, BDSM demon mom that he summons to destroy everything.
Mm-hmm.
So after this attack, nobody really knows what happened here. And Tidus calls out Auron, is just like, hey, this is all your fault. Like, you dragged me into this stuff.
Right. And in response to this, Auron says, hey, stop tearing me down. You should be mad at your dad because Jekt is sin. Shh, don't tell anyone.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the beginning of like some of the secrets in the game that are kept for longer than they need to be.
Yeah.
Like the party makes decisions that would be aided by having this information, but it's just a secret for a long time for, you know, and nobody tells Tidus that summoners are sacrificed at the end of their journey for longer than you would need to not tell him.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, they're just secrets set up for dramatic purposes rather than like naturalistic, like character or plot purposes.
Yeah, like explaining the mission. There's a justification. There's a melodramatic justification given for it that lends, you know, it's effective as, you know, emotional melodrama. It is contrived.
It's contrived. Like the actual payoff ends up being effective.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual reasoning behind it doesn't end up making a lot of sense. And it contributes to, in me, like a general sense of this game being a little bit weaker because characters are doing actions that don't make sense.
Right.
You know, and this will get worse. Like once Yuna starts driving, like Yuna does a couple real dumb things in relation to Seymour that just don't make very much sense.
Yeah.
And it's hard to spend a bunch of time with characters that like are just do things that like, you just like, why would you do that? You know, there's a whole, like that's what horror movies are about, but that's part of the thrill, and horror movies are 2 hours.
Right.
Like this is where you're just kind of continuously spending time with characters making the wrong move over and over.
Yeah.
And not even one that like feels like they're trying to make the right move, you know?
Yeah.
So this ends up being a weird secret that I don't like. Keeping a secret for a time makes sense. You know, like you're not even a guardian yet, but yeah.
The other thing here that helps piece together the time travel mystery, Orin says, hey, I helped defeat Sin back when Braska was on his pilgrimage. And then I went to Xanarkand to watch over you, Tidus. And that's, you know, and that's why I brought you here.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we know that he's actually from this world, but went over to that world.
It's not clear what the relationship is. Is it time? You know, is it a vortex? Is it a new physical place? All that will be answered. Kinda.
Yep. 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 Orin comes up and says, hey, can I be a guardian? And of course, this is like Michael Jordan joining your like PB basketball team, you know. He's a legendary guardian.
I pick Ken Griffey Jr.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like, you know, the condition is Tidus gets to join as well.
Right.
And you know why this anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's sweet on him. So she says yes. And then we get the scene.
Yeah. This has been litigated quite a bit. The summary of the scene is that, you know, Yuna senses that Tidus is distraught because he is witnessing all this death and destruction. He has learned that Jekt is the monster and is, you know, keeping that pain to himself. And she says, hey, you know, we are the hope of Spira by going on this. Guardians and summoners need to be this bastion. So we need to smile and laugh even when we don't feel like it. And so she forces him to fake laugh, and it is incredibly pronounced. It is literally him shouting, ha, 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 ha.
And they both kind of do it for a long time.
Yeah.
Where do you fall on this infamous scene here, Matt? What is your take on this? Because it has its defenders.
I'm a defender. I'm okay with it because to me, it's intentionally meant to be cringy, and they're intentionally fake laughing.
Yeah.
And I also think that they throw some good tidbits in there, like when it's all over with and Yuna looks at Tidus and she says, you probably shouldn't laugh anymore. Or then when Waka, you know, he's off to the side and he says, we were worried you guys were going crazy.
Yeah.
So they make fun of it themselves. I don't have a problem with that.
I don't think that it belongs, you know, on top 10 fails in video game voice acting, specifically because there is intention there, like saying like, listen to how weird these people laugh. The intention was for it to be forced. However, just because you mean to tell a joke doesn't mean that you laugh
you
at
landed
it.
It.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So it's weird because like, I feel like it's infamous. It's infamous for the wrong reasons, and I don't think that the reason that it is that it should be infamous is actually that like bad. Like
yeah.
It's just like a problem when people say they don't want to play this game because of this scene.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a little bit that's a little bit silly.
Yeah,
like it's like the reason that it's weird, like it's meant to be funny. It's not like it's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It you know that it happened. It's just weirdly like Lynchian. You know, out of nowhere, like the performances are just very strange in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really, really awkward. Like these characters don't like a character trying to like, it doesn't feel like what it's meant to feel like to me. It doesn't feel executed that well, where like the idea is that she's saying put on a happy face and they're kind of just having this goofy moment. Like, it doesn't feel like that to me. Like, it doesn't feel like this would make each other laugh very much. You know, like, they do call it out and the dialogue says it, but it doesn't carry over to me very well. The story behind it, the localizer actually went to the guy who wrote it and was like, hey, this, nobody acts like this. This is real weird. And he said, no, I want to include that because I've been taking acting classes and they ask us to do that. And I'm like, that's a weird, okay, that's a weird reason, but like, okay, you know, I guess, you know, that's a reason, you know, that you're doing those, but that's the way it came through. But people who were like localizing it were like, hey, this is going to go off pretty weird.
Yeah.
This is gonna be received weirdly. And it did, like, and it is like, you know, I agree that it doesn't belong on like the greatest video game voice acting fails. It's not, you know, where my Arctic blast? Like, it's not that. It's just an awkward scene in a game with like a lot of awkward dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not like it's that far off the mean of some of the, you know, some of the performances we get.
Yeah. It's so, also something that I think works better on a second playthrough because you understand just how artificial the summoner's role in perpetuating this forever war is. You know, like it is thematically sound in that, you know, we have to do a lot of artifice to keep people just placid enough to not to actually not fight against their situation. Yeah. Right.
That's absolutely part of it, too. And part of like doing a reveal is you have to be mindful about the time between, like, you don't set up a magic trick and then pay it off 4 days later.
Yeah.
You know, like you set this up and you could. If while this was in mind where somebody's like, that's weird and still asking questions about it, they're like, why did that happen? Then we learned that summoners sacrificed themselves. So that's part of why it's so important to her to like, why she's so sad and she has to like carry this brave face. If we learned about the artifice of the religion, then it would feel like a puzzle piece was sliding into place.
Yeah.
But instead, by the time we learned that, it's 30 hours later.
Yeah.
So and all that stands out is that it's this weird thing in a vacuum and it feels very hard to relate it to the game.
What's strange about it is like it when she says it, it's almost like a platitude. Like it means a lot more. I mean, I think to her, like the actual meaning of what she's saying is like is there, but it comes across as just like a thing that you say, like, oh, just put on a brave face.
Which I think was them holding that card really close to their vest. Like this game keeping its like mysteries and wanting to have its reveals in a way that is not always handled super well.
Yeah.
You know, if it was very clear something was wrong with her about this, even if they didn't tell it, but if they really tipped that hand a little bit more, maybe this would feel a little bit better.
Yeah.
And just the weirdness would feel correct because it'd be like, something is wrong.
Yeah.
That's why people are acting in a weird way because something is definitely wrong. It just doesn't come off like that though. It comes off as weirdly kind of light.
Yeah.
You know, and we've just seen several apocalypses. Like it's also just that the weird tonalness of this tone of this game.
And I know I defended it. It's, to me, it's actually not the cringiest forced smile or laugh scene in the game.
Are you talking about Kamari?
Yes.
The Kamari smile is very good. Yeah. There's some, I've seen some like still shots of this when I was just like doing research. Like some people have pulled some real Waka stills of him having a really weird face, like really off model. Like the cutscene where they all, everybody... The high detail versions, there's a couple that are very off model and weird that are very funny. There's also like the underwater sex scene, which is pretty awkward, which we'll get to. And I think that's a very also pretty cringy scene. So this is not as bad as it seems, but it's also, you know, anyway, it is what it is.
Although, Cole, you bring up a good point. You said you wanted to hear the German translation of this game.
OK,
I wonder what this scene would be like.
Oh, God.
it feels like that would be that's an easy question and answer. You should check that out because it's probably
how have I not looked that up
in every language. I would watch a YouTube supercut of this scene in all of the game languages this has been translated into.
Yeah. So now that we have learned to laugh again, our next that destination is Josei, the temple at Josei. But to get there, we have to pass by the first thing that feels kind of world mappy a little bit, the Mihen High Road. which is a couple of screens of very placid fields. It's very bucolic. And this is where it kind of hammered home, like, oh yeah, we're all on this pilgrimage together. We're going to be seeing some familiar faces of people who are traveling alongside us.
Well, this is explicitly, I think, to introduce the side characters.
Yes.
Like, this is the road where we meet them. And it's really, like, comes at kind of a clip. Like, a lot of times you meet somebody and then you go like a few steps down the road and it's another one of these, and a few steps down the road and another one. Like, they just happen very, kind of jerky,
mm-hmm.
these introductions to these people. They all do kind of have satisfying payoffs, though. Like,
yeah.
It, you know, this game has it feels like it has a smaller kind of world cast to it, and a smaller like cast of character, like player characters, actually, even though it's not that much smaller, but it feels like it.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because we don't get Auron until just now, and we don't get Riku for a while yet.
No.
But the actual characters that we have as side characters or NPCs in this do get kind of complete good arcs.
No.
Near the end, because they're impacted by the same thing you are. Like, once that religion gets disillusioned, you know, it's a big deal.
Yeah. So we have Auron. We should talk about that. He's our heavy hitter kind of guy. He's like a knight from Final Fantasy Tactics, where his skills are debuffs on different enemies. And his overdrive, it's a little bit like Sabin's special attacks from FF6.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You input commands.
So yeah, he's going to be your heavy hitter. And he pretty much always had a place in my party because of such.
Yeah, you know, my forever party, like, you know, if I wanted to wreck shop, it would be Auron, Lulu, and Waka.
Okay. Yeah, I similar for me, but I would have Tidus in there, because the time mage, like hasting and stuff, is just very useful.
Yeah. He'd be in there for the first round, and then he'd be out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You're on the bench. We run into these Chocobo Knights there, which are a weird little side thing. We have the Crusaders. We also have the Chocobo Knights that don't get as much story or development as the Crusaders do. Like these main Chocobo Knights do have a story that goes with them, but it is kind of weirdly, I don't really understand these guys' place in the world so much. It felt like just a way to have Chocobos.
Yeah. It's like the Spear of Highway Patrol.
Yeah.
The sense that I get about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
this is our first encounter with a historian who will tell you stories about the places where he's at.
Mm-hmm. Which is very useful.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet a lady summoner, like Beleria or something like that. I can't remember her name.
Belgamine.
And she does Pokemon battles with you to teach you things. Sometimes these are tutorial things. And I think this one or the next one, she teaches you how to customize your summons, a system I never used.
Yeah. it's really useful for adding healing skills to your peeps. You know, especially like Valfur, it's good for them. With Shiva, Ixion, and Ifrit, you just cast your element on yourself to heal.
Yeah. Well, and Valfur like just became unuseful to me generally.
Yeah,
like I kind of benched him pretty early, so like I could see why it would be useful if I was using him more, but I just kind of stopped using him.
A little further in, we get a stop at an Albed truck stop. There are these travel centers around, which I like quite a bit.
Yep.
Stop at the Flying J. And this is where Tidus has the calm explained to him, saying like, hey, sin always comes back. The calm that we are fighting for is that time where he is being reborn and people don't have to live in fear of, you know, Killika being wiped off the map. And what the summoner is doing, like, hey, you know, Xanarkand is our ultimate goal. So that's lucky for you. We need to get there and perform this final summoning, you know, to do this epic battle.
Yep. And this is also, I think, the first Waka racism stuff.
Yeah.
It really ramps up, but this is where it begins. So, like, Waka does not like the Albed. In the religion of Yevon, the Albed, since they still use Machina, are considered heathens.
Yes.
And stuff, and Waka does not like them.
He pulls all the stops out in terms of like just general racist behavior. Like if something unrelated happens, he will immediately blame the Albed.
Yeah, I kept expecting him to be like, I can't believe I have to press one for English, you know, and like two for Albed. Like it just feels, it's a very classic racism that he has. It is very surprising. Like there's no slurs or anything,
right?
You know, it's not like we're playing Mafia 3, but like it's it's just intense.
It's real divisive, right? Because you like, or personally divisive, because you like his performance. He's an affable guy who is really helpful, and he's a useful party member. But this, like, he is both racist and a religious bigot, and incredibly small-minded in a way that is like, oh, you're a good character, but like, you're a terrible person.
Well, he's just dumb.
Yeah.
You know, it's his whole thing, and he gets over it just because he kind of has no choice to, but he's just too slow on the uptake not to be racist.
He only gets over it because he is pummeled by so many tragedies in a row.
Yeah.
That he just like, well, what's the point in being upset about this anymore?
Yeah. We literally like have to unmake him and deconstruct him to make him not, you know, racist. And weirdly, like, I didn't remember from the first time I played it that Lulu was also like a pretty hardcore Yavinite. She's just the reasonable one.
Right.
Like they're kind of characters are joined at the hip. She is just as faithful as he is. Mm-hmm. She's just not a bigot about it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just kind of interesting that like, you know, and they're really close and they have a baby. They get married in Final Fantasy X2 in the good ending.
Yeah.
So like there's obviously something there. Mm-hmm. And he grows a lot. Like he, you know, he becomes not a racist. He apologizes and does his, that rubbing the back of his neck animation that he does 1,000 times in this game.
Yeah.
So the you talk about like what you life will be like. You talk to Yuna about like what life will be like after you defeat Sin. Mm-hmm. And she's very cagey about this. She doesn't say like, hey, you know, I don't have a life after we defeat Sin.
Yeah, I've saved up a down payment on a house.
I'm not starting any long novels, just so you know. And we heard about this beast that was eating chocobos. So in the morning at the inn, the chocobo eater attacks, a little on the nose. And this is a boss fight that I think is kind of interesting because it has an alternate lose condition.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose this, you don't actually lose the game.
You just go to a different part of the dungeon.
Yep. It's trying to push you off this cliff.
Yeah.
And if you do enough damage to him, you can knock him down and push him back.
Mm-hmm.
And
Yep. I like that quite a bit. I like the football element of that, of, you know, pushing for territory. It's quite neat. He's got a ton of HP. Like, this is a fight that I think you are kind of meant to lose if you're not being cagey about doing a bunch of damage as quickly as possible. And strangely, the Chocobo Eater, I think this might be its first appearance in every Final Fantasy game. The Chocobo Eater ends up coming back after this. So he becomes like a bit of a mascot for the latter Final Fantasies. Yeah. It's like like one of the first major bosses you fight in like Lightning Returns. And I only know that because I guessed on that podcast. Cool fight. I didn't get knocked off this time because I'm a champ. Did you guys?
No.
Okay. Nope. We're all champs.
Camp champs. It's kind of annoying from a completionist perspective because when you get the area you get knocked down into, there's treasure and stuff down there you might want. You know, so you'd end up having to backtrack to where you. I'm not a completionist, but like I remember as a kid. Getting knocked down and then going and finding the place, backtracking to the place where if I didn't just see what was there, because video games, you explore both the pathways, you know?
Of course. Yeah. I bought the game.
Yeah, exactly. Once you get to the end of the high road, you learn what the Crusaders are planning. They've been carting these Sin Spawn to this area called Mushroom Rock because they're trying to lure Sin. Like Sin is attracted by Sin Spawn. It's one of the reasons why it's good to kill them.
Sin always comes back for a spawn. There's a nice double meaning in that, which is he's not actually going after the Sin Spawn. He's going after Tito's.
Yeah. And which are also his kids.
Yeah,
they're both his kids. But they have this machina that they're going to hit it with this big laser. This is very, I didn't really realize until we started recording how many parallels there are with Final Fantasy VII.
Mm-hmm.
With this is very Rufus and Shinra versus the weapon.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a thing. This is called Operation Mihen.
Right.
And you're trying to get through here. You have to just pass through and you get cock-blocked, but Seymour comes through and says, they're with me.
Yeah, says, they're with me. Yeah. I am an ignoct and this is her. So this gets us up to Mushroom Rock Road. This is kind of a frustrating area from a combat perspective because the enemy I encountered the most was the gigantic bird dinosaur that looked a little bit like Valfor that had a ton of HP. So
yeah. I think that thing can is the first, if I'm remembering right, I think that might be the first one that can petrify you. If I remember, petrifying works interestingly in this game. Like you get petrified and you're fine until you get hit and then you die. And there are two different ways your characters can die in this game. You can die and be able to be Phoenix downed, but you can also die and have that slot knocked out.
Yeah.
Like nobody can come and take that slot, and that's a real big deal because you're down 2/3 strength for the rest of the battle.
Yeah.
So.
So more evidence in the Seymour is a villain pile. You know, Waka says, "Hey, Seymour, you know, you're 1/4 of the popes in this world. Why would a Maester of Yevon, like, be present for an operation that uses Machina? Why would you sanction this?" And Seymour says, "Well, pretend you didn't see the Machina." Waka says, "Wait a minute, that's not something a Maester would say." And then he says, "Oh, pretend I didn't say it." So they're playing fast and loose.
Yep. And I think, I mean, you know, we mentioned this earlier, but like, it's the Machina specifically in their religion is what caused sin in the first place.
Yes. You were going to say something, Matt?
I was just going to say, like, up to this point of the game, I really liked Seymour. I thought Seymour was like a badass. You know, they get blocked out of, you know, going down Mushroom Rock Road. Seymour just comes in and, you know, says, "They're with me." And then this whole thing of pretend I didn't say it. He just seems like a badass.
I knew there was, he was going to be something that was going to be evil about him, you know, about it. And I think that if he were designed differently, I think I would like him more as a villain.
Yeah.
Designed differently and a different motivation. Like for me, like earlier Final Fantasy games ruined this guy's motivation for me.
Yeah.
The kind of nihilist Final Fantasy villain is like a card they played a few too many times. And there are more charismatic versions of that to my mind, but this is a good read. Like this little bit, like pretend you didn't see them, pretend I didn't say it. Like that's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's very dismissive. And I think that you mentioned this earlier, Cole, like where he gets dismissive earlier, where he's like, why are you still here? Like Seymour at his best is dismissive.
Yes.
And that's a really good posture for a villain to take. It's very like kind of fun.
Yeah. It's good. You know, just the fact that everybody else is adhering to these rules, but he as the leader is not.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. So we're headed to the command center. We find a crusader, you know, who is a little bit frustrated because he's been locked out of the operation. There's a bit of a dramatic beat here where he says, like, "Hey, you know, if we die, you need to know I was the one who convinced Chapu to enlist in the Crusaders."
Yeah.
And
Bako's just having his bad times begin now.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So we get up. Oran sees another one of the maesters here. We see Maester Keenock, who's the leader of these warrior monks, kind of the military arm of Yevon. They have history. Oran used to be one of these monks.
Yep. Keenock looks like a Cabbage Patch doll.
He does.
It's a brutal own, but I gotta pull it out because he's really gross looking. It's really weird. He's got real dimply cheeks. So they have history.
Yeah.
The operation begins, and they show, it's kind of neat. They show the sin spawn in these cages and stuff, like trying to get out and stuff. Like you just know it's going to go bad. It's like Jurassic Park, you know, they have a bunch of raptors in the cages or whatever. Right. This sin spawn GUI attacks this like big centipede creature. So yeah. We can have, he's a graphics card.
Yeah.
It's so we can have a boss fight before the cutscene failure happens.
Yes. This is a cool fight because he doesn't really attack you directly that much. Instead, what he does is he will use Demi, which by definition cannot kill you. It just halves your HP. But he will try to lay poison on you as quickly as possible. So that will finish you off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you don't know how serious poison is yet, you know it now.
Yeah.
You know?
And if you don't know that Demi won't kill you on its own, you know it now.
Yeah. You're learning a lot. Yeah. And then so they try to shoot it. You know, but it
tries to shoot Sin, like Sin's floating out there.
Yeah. Yeah. The laser cannon that they have, the old Machina laser cannon they got with the Albed, Albed's help. They try to shoot it. It does not work. Sin has a shield, like a force field that they did not know about.
Right.
And then Sin, destroys tons of, just vaporizes a bunch of crusaders on the beach.
Yeah. They shoot it. They cause the shield to go up. And that is what, destroys most of the, most of their front. We get a little break, classic Final Fantasy beat, where the villain joins you, Seymour, to do a fight, and we get a comparison. We see how quickly he dispatches the Sinspawn GUI. You know, it's the only time you get to play as him. I think he has an overdrive that you can fire.
You can look it up online. It's just, you know, a bunch of cool particle effects and damage, but it looks neat.
Yeah, can't summon, can't bring anima in because that might be overpowered. for this moment. But yeah, this is not enough. You know, Sin continues to wipe out the beachhead, and you wake up and everybody is extremely despondent because their last best hope, the thing they thought would work, just led to more death.
Yep. Yeah. And this is, you know, your glory, like that shot in glory.
Yeah. Pan left,
like everyone is dead.
Yeah.
You know, you look through, you're by yourself, your party's not together. Like, you don't know who's still alive. Like, you know, because you're a video game player, you know, and that's fine. But, you know, you don't know that, you know, Tidus doesn't know.
Right, right. And Tidus, in his, you know, bullheadedness, he like tries to swim after Sin. You know, so
yeah.
Like, I knew it was pointless, but I just couldn't stop myself from doing it. And as he's doing this, we get a flashback. Jekt, in addition to all of this, was also a problem drinker.
Yeah.
And that caused problems for the family as well.
Yep. Yeah. He's explicitly a drunk. Oh. Which is kind of, you know, that doesn't feel very Final Fantasy to have that as like, that feels like a very human problem for these games.
Right.
You know, so it's, you know, it's good. Like it's good that they do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they have him be a drunk. So we learn he's drunk, and then they do ascending, like all these corpses, probably the biggest ascending in quite a while.
Yeah.
You know, it's gonna sweep the Sendies in 2019.
big ship and a Pyrefly is coming in.
Yep. Yep. And Seymour then hits on Yuna pretty grotesquely.
Yeah. It starts up kind of the weird subplot and motivation for this kind of middle third of the game.
Yep.
And with Yuna preoccupied, all we have left is Kimari to cheer Tidus up with his grotesque smile.
Yep. Here's I am. Welcome to Five Nights at Freddy's. I'm Kimari. And here's my terrible smile.
I think they purposely didn't up-res it for the HD remake. I think they kept it lo-fi just so it would be monstrous.
It's very good. I just Google image search Kimari smile, and there's a lot of good stuff going on in this. Yeah.
And that's where we're going to leave this for the first episode here. Matt, I know kind of in the lead up to this, maybe in the green room, you talked about, you know, going to bat for the first leg of this game, for kind of the road trip part of it. Is there anything, like, you know, in summation about this section that you want to get out there?
No, not really. I mean, just I kind of get the aspect of it slower right now. A lot of the battles are repetitive. It's like you guys said, it's each person you bring in is a key and the enemy is a lock and you just have to get the right matchup. And the encounter rate is very high. And so it is very slow. But I like the cutscenes in between. I like the story that's starting to be laid out for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think eventually some of this stuff will pay off. Not all of it, but some of it I think pays off, and some of it pays off very well. I think for me, the reason why this first entry, like this is the first kind of uptick, is the war, you know, is the army, you know, this kind of thing. It just needed some drama to me. Like I just needed some more bad things to happen to me that really, like, and, you know, spoiler, I mean, there's no real spoilers. It's a very old game. Once you fight Seymour and kill him and become fugitives for the first time, like, I feel like that's when the game finds its like real sense of drama.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the characters are all kind of upended. You're upended with the church, everything like that. Like, this still feels like it is just very slowly playing its hand, just a little bit too much for me. And this kind of first third, and even still kind of a little bit further into this, was as bored as I kind of got with the game. Like, it took a little while for me to get hooked back into the story, which is, it's weird in the context of the series, because usually I think Final Fantasy games, the first disc is the strongest by a lot.
Yeah.
You know, the beginning of 7, 8, 9, definitely the strongest discs,
right?
You know, pretty easily. The beginning of 6 with the returners and everything is very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the beginning of 4, very compelling. Like they that's how they kind of do it. And this one, it's a very slow burn.
Yeah.
You know, and like some of the payoff works for me, some of it doesn't. But just because there's that payoff, I just wish that it was paced a little bit better. You know?
Yeah. Weirdly, I think that they didn't do themselves a lot of favors. So the idea of this being a road trip, right? Going on this pilgrimage, I think that is good and fine. But by sticking so close to there's going to be a road, there's going to be a town, there's going to be a temple, there's going to be a road, there's going to be a town, there's going to be a temple. It weirdly sets it into like Zelda pacing. Like,
yeah,
I can see by the interface that there are 8 medallions I need to get. So we're, you know, like the mystery is a little bit taken away. It's only when you are kind of like taken off of that road that I think that it starts getting, that I start being invested, because I don't know what the next turn's going to be.
Well, and part of that road trip pacing, what you want for that is that every time you go to one of these towns or something like that, you're in a different place. Like a Zelda road trip, something that's like, oh, I'm in an ice world full of these like ice goblins, and now I'm in the land of the rock friendly rock band, and now I'm in the land of the Zora. You know, like it is a tour of very different locations.
Yeah.
Here it just kind of not.
Yeah.
You know, like spirit culture at this point feels very monolithic. Like there's nothing to separate Kalika from, you know, Luca.
Yeah.
Like yeah. And that's kind of part of that disappointment is just like the culture itself is interesting. Like the reliance on sport and the reliance on religion is interesting, but there's not a lot of shade to it yet.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of maybe what I'm missing in that road trip part of this game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but we're going to set up some stuff later that is good. And we're going to have the end game of this game, which I think actually has a few like genuinely really hard hitting emotional punches that are good.
Yeah.
In the next episode, Matt, is there anything like on, do you do stuff online? Do you want people to follow you online? Is that a nuisance or is that good?
I have zero social media.
Okay.
No, that's smart. Stay strong, man.
I don't know if it is, but I've never had it, and I've stayed away from it.
Yeah,
it's awesome. It is good. I think that it is the smart thing to do.
Yeah.
So a big thank you, I guess, then to Matt. Yeah. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
I'll talk about you like you're not here. Thank you, Matt. I'm talking to you right now. Thank you.
Well, thank you, guys.
All right. Well, we let Matt go so he wouldn't have to listen to us shill. Because we're kind.
Yeah.
But also who's kind, Matt.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun having him on.
Yeah. This concludes part one of our Final Fantasy X coverage. Tune in next week for part two. If you like this show, the best possible thing you can do is support us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv, you can throw us a couple bucks at the $5 level. You will get full episodes of WAF. Some episodes of WAF per month will end up being kind of a premium episode. If you want the whole enchilada, which includes Bioshock Infinite next month, that is for $5 backers. And the reason I bring that up now is because we also have the very first Watch Out for Fireballs dispatch coming up.
Yes, we do. So if you go to Patreon, you can scroll down, look for the post, look for something called like, you know, WAF dispatch, call for responses and prompts or something like that. That is the way that you will interact with us there. You put them in and then we pull them out of that. Anybody who has done like duck tracks in the past will recognize that.
Yeah. You can give us Q&As. You can give us kind of longer subjects to talk about. And that episode will be us kind of doing a freeform conversation for a time about one of those longer subjects, doing Q&As and then reading your responses to Owlboy, River City Ransom, and Final Fantasy X.
Yep.
So hit us up with those at duckfeed.tv/contact.
Yeah, should be a good time. If you are writing in about any of if you're writing in about multiple games, please separate those, like write different emails about them, just because it is easier to kind of file the different things. It's strictly like a bookkeeping and organization concession.
We have gotten a couple questions about this. So the patrons can submit prompts. Those episodes come out for everybody.
Yes.
So if you can also write in if you have anything to say about our games for February, one of which I already mentioned, which is Bioshock Infinite, the other two being Pyre and Super Mario Brothers 2. That is also duckfeed.tv/contact.
Yeah. So we welcome your input, and we got some really good stuff planned for next month and 2019. It's gonna be a good time.
For people listening, we mentioned the Patreon. At $5, you also get in on these Bonfireside Chat 2.0. We'll be starting our coverage of Immortal Unchained. You'll want to hear that because that is, you know, even if you don't like Dark Souls, you probably want to hear just about games because you like here. Games. You're here.
You might also like. Yeah,
you might also like Bonfireside Chat 2.0. So there's just a lot of benefits if you do patronize us. And that's just some of them.
Yes.
You can also, if you cannot do that, another way to support the show is to rate and review it on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or anywhere podcasts are sold.
Yeah. And go tell your friends. Link if you got a friend who loves a particular game, you can link them to an episode about a game that we have covered. Go through our back catalog.
Almost 225 games at this point, so or episodes. But probably more than that in terms of games.
A little bit less. We have a lot of multiple the split EPs and the multi-part episodes about single games end up kind of balancing each other out. It's at about like 218 right now.
Yeah, 218 is a lot.
Yeah.
So check that out. You know, until next time.
Yeah. Ha 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 ha.
What's a guardian?